Hey.
Yes, we are good to go.
All right. Welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District No. 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, August 25th, 2021. This meeting will consist of three parts: Board Governance Education from 2 to 2:15, Board Education from 2:15 to 3:15, when we will take a 15-minute recess and reconvene at 3:30 for our business session. The session is being officially audio recorded and times shown on the agenda are estimates only. This virtual meeting is being held under Governor Inslee's COVID-19 Notice of Proclamation 2028, and there will be no live public comment period, but our community members are welcome to comment on any item or concern via a letter addressed to the commissioners at 834 Sheridan Street, Port Townsend, Washington 98368, or via email to commissioners@jeffersonhealthcare.org. All commissioners are present with the exception of Commissioner Koff, who is excused as he is taking a well-deserved short vacation. I now call for a move to approve today's agenda.
So move.
Second.
Discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Okay. Our governance education portion is a report on the community health improvement program. John Nowak, our CHIP director, is retiring after more than 40 years of service to our community and to Jefferson Healthcare. John is a registered nurse who worked in various settings here for a number of years, and then transitioned into information technology just in time for the Y2K, or the millennium bug, a computer flaw that may have caused havoc with systems if it weren't for diligent IT people like John, who worked to ensure that Jefferson Healthcare would be up and running on January 1st, 2000. Thanks to John, we were, and we still are. John also led our Lean Continuous Improvement Program before becoming a director of the Community Health Improvement Plan, which is a collaborative effort with the hospital district and the public health department to identify, prioritize, and address our community's health issues. John could not be here today to present this, but let it be known how much we appreciate him and his efforts and all that he has done for the people of Jefferson County and for Jefferson Healthcare. Thank you, John. We hope your retirement will bring you long-lived pleasure. And we hope that you will not miss us as much as we will miss you. So thank you. So we have had John's report, and have you all had time to look at it?
Yes.
Okay. So I welcome questions, comments on the report. What do you think? Who wants to go first? Matt, I think you were one who is pretty interested in this, as we all are, but you have really interest in it. Do you have any comments on it?
I mean, a great report. I think the Community Health Improvement Program is really an important program, you know, and I think we should be, it's in everyone in this community's interest to keep it strong. And, we should be, so I'm supportive of whatever we need to do to keep the program strong. And so I look forward to getting back into the swing where we were getting, I believe at one point we were getting like quarterly reports from the CHIP program. I guess I'm curious when, what's the, you know, sort of outlook over the next few years? How often are we going to be doing, working with partners to do community health needs assessments, and updating the CHIP, program? So I guess, I'm curious about the future, sort of like what it's going to look like. And the report made it clear. A lot of these things are unclear at the moment.
So, I'm
glad that we got some information.
Okay, great. That's a good question. It looks like there are plans in the future, well underway. So I'm assuming that we'll be getting reports now and again on the process. So we will keep us informed. Thank you, Matt. Bruce, what do you think?
Well, again, I enjoyed seeing the report because it's been a while since we had an update. And like just about everything else, it's clear to see that, you know, COVID had a big impact on some of the things they're able to do because they weren't able to have their regular meetings and things like they normally would have. And so, like Matt said, there's a lot of things where, you know, they're still looking for or waiting for data, you know, to finalize plans for moving ahead. But it's hard when you can't have meetings in person. So I understand, you know, a lot of why they are where they are right now. But again, I would echo what Matt says. It's important that we continue and move ahead as well as we can and support them however we can.
Great. Thanks, Bruce. Mari?
Yes, well, I reiterate both what Matt and Bruce have said, and I think the CHIP has been a great asset to our community, focusing on public health issues. Although public health is not totally our purview, it is very important to the health and well-being of our entire community. And I think, likewise, however CHIP continues, and whatever we can do to support that program that we've done in the past, would be certainly have my vote. It is so essential to have a robust, as we can see because of coronavirus, a robust public health system, which I think we should support as much as we can with other agencies too. I think two gentlemen have said exactly the right thing, because that's what we need, robust public health and continuing with the hospital-based system in primary care to work together and get things done.
Thank you, Mari. I agree with everybody, and I think the collaborative effort between the two organizations is well worth it too. That's, you know, we dovetail so much, and we have to continue that. Mike's done an incredible job keeping that all together. Mike, do you have any comments on it that you'd like to bring forth?
Well, it feels like the CHIP program is in transition right now. It's because it's in significant transition. Not only John's position, but Vicky's position over at Public Health, is in the Apple is in the place of or in the process of replacing Vicky, and I believe they are going to spend some time thinking about best future path for leadership. And we are a very engaged and interested party in that discussion. I stand like all of you where CHIP is important. The hospital is gonna be there and be a big player. And we look forward to participating in that discussion.
Great. Good. Well, okay, if there's, are there any other comments that anybody would like to make or questions? Well, then at this time, we could go right ahead into our second portion of the governance education, which is a pharmaceutical update by Nell Allen, our pharmaceutical technician specialist. Nell, welcome.
Yeah. Jill, maybe before Nell starts, I will give a little introduction to that. You know, I'm constantly amazed at all of the incredible work that's going on here at Jefferson Healthcare throughout the entire organization. Some the most of it, I'm aware of. But some of the great work I'm not as aware of as I should be, and I think this is a great example of that. A couple of weeks ago, when we were out at Port Ludlow celebrating our 10th anniversary, Nell, who has been with Port Ludlow Pharmacy from the beginning and is, you know, if you ask any resident of Port Ludlow, will say is kind of the heart and soul of the pharmacy, was at the anniversary. And I started talking with her, and she reminded me of this program that she started a couple of years ago, basically just to help a patient or two who really had found themselves in a bad place with requiring an expensive drug that there were no conventional programs to help that person. And I was vaguely familiar with that, but I had no idea of the scope and the scale that this program had grown to and the number of people we were able to help. So I encourage Nell to think about presenting to the board, because I think this is just precisely the type of work that is going on in the organization that you need to know about. And also, it's a great feather in the cap of Nell and her team, because it's making a huge difference in the lives of many patients out there. So I'm happy to turn the presentation over to Nell Allen. So Nell, do your thing.
Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate that a lot. Thank you guys so much for having me. This is great. So for those of you who don't know me, I'm Nell Allen. I'm the pharmacy technician specialist out at our Port Ludlow Retail Pharmacy. I'm going to talk a little bit about our programs out there, but I just wanted to throw in our Getting to Yes as my title was sort of, I should say, gifted to me from Janelle Harper in oncology when I worked at the clinic there for her. It's more of a philosophy than just a title. And I think I've tried to take that with me when I went out to Port Ludlow to do a lot of our specialty prescriptions and things, which also involves oncology. Slide, please. So just so everybody knows, these are the main things that we do out at Port Ludlow. We have specialty, our outpatient retail, which is basically everything else, and then hospice. I'm not going to talk a lot about hospice today because hospice is kind of a closed system. It's kind of its own thing. Most of the assistance and programs that this is about really apply more to specialty and outpatient. Slide, please. So what I really want to share is, you know, the current programs we have, who the people are and the different medicines that we cover, how we kind of came to this need, to realize we had a need, what we ended up having to pull together, and how and why they work. Last slide. So currently what we have, and I'll explain more of these as we go along, but currently what we have is our copay assistance for people that have insurance, private grants, which can be, usually is for people that have insurance as well, but that's separate and outside of the hospital. And then uncompensated care, we don't do a whole lot of, but that's more just if somebody is has no insurance, no additional assistance. We have a couple of homeless patients. Slide, please. So who we help, this is the best part. So right now it is only Jefferson Healthcare patients. So we will fill prescriptions for anyone. The assistance only really works within our system right now with our own providers and patients. So we have the main ones are really kind of top to bottom there. You know, oncology is the greatest need, and some of that's because they're the most expensive. ACU and ER kind of come right in behind there, you know, with people that are being discharged on things that they did not come in on. And ER is, again, people that don't even have always have insurance and they've had an accident. Primary care is kind of joining in too, and as people are hearing about us, primary care has some need there too. And then I always put in case by case because there's always extras. Like I said, you know, we had a gentleman who lost his medicine that was living at the homeless shelter. So there's always different ones there. Slide, please. So as far as what we cover, honestly, there isn't anything that is off the table. Oncology is the biggest one for, again, most expensive. Another one that has gotten really popular is the DOACs, the direct acting oral anticoagulants that usually come out of ACU or the ER. Those are pretty spendy. And again, it's one where somebody comes into the hospital not expecting to come out on that. So those are pretty popular for our programs. Some inhalers, some insulin, and again, anything else just kind of depends on the patient. Slide, please. So we had to kind of figure out, maybe I should back up a little bit. When we first opened the pharmacy, you know, we wanted to help all these different groups of people. You're always at the mercy of Medicare a little bit. And of course, the greatest need, especially being in Port Ludlow, are people that are on Medicare. So again, patient need, I'm mostly going to talk about Medicare today. Commercial insurance is in there as well, because, you know, some of those still have really high, especially high deductibles. And then there's always the case by case, but most of this applies to our Medicare patients. Slide, please. So I did have this nice graph of how Medicare Part D works. Not that you want to get into all of that today, because that's a lot. So I actually threw that out, and this image really kind of tells it all. And I think anybody, even if you are not familiar with Medicare, can probably get the idea from this. So every patient has this $445 deductible, and then everybody has to go through this initial coverage period. And then once you end up in this donut hole, which they say doesn't exist anymore, it does. They just, now it's called the coverage gap and not the donut hole. It's kind of like the artist formerly known as Prince. It's still there. So to get back through until you come out into a catastrophic coverage period where you would actually get more help from Medicare, you have to spend $6,550. So that's a lot for most people. And some of these oncology drugs are $20,000. So you're going to go right through that, you know, in the first month. Slide, please. So that's the simplified version and really all you need to know about Medicare Part D today. I did put in some example drugs just so you guys could see. These are things that we fill all the time. And that's not a mistake. It's a 30-day supply. The top one is $25,000 a month. The next one is $18,000 a month. And the cheapest one on this list is $461. I guess I just wanted to throw that out there because when I even first started doing specialty, I hadn't dealt with numbers quite that big before. And when people are paying 10% of something, you know, when it's smaller, it doesn't look quite like that. So just to give you guys an idea. Slide, please. So when you get into this, where then somebody has a copay that is very large, and I mean, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 large, what are our options for the pharmacy? You know, big pharmacies like Safeway, you know, they have their own rules. But what can we do within our, you know, within a smaller setting where we can maybe pick and choose a little bit? When you have a patient that has a high deductible or copay, you can send them to the manufacturer. There are manufacturer programs for some drugs, not all drugs, but the ones that are there, they can be very generous. The problem is you have to send the patient away. So they have to go to the manufacturer. The prescription's actually filled at the manufacturer's pharmacy and sent to the patient in the mail. So you lose both the patient and the prescription. And that's not why we opened the pharmacy. We didn't open it to send people away. So that's a last resort. It's there, but that's not my first choice. The other one, which we had some suggestions when we consulted with Swedish when we first opened the specialty pharmacy in Port Ludlow, was grants. And grants are amazing and very generous. They're also hit or miss. The funding for them often runs out by the 15th of January of every calendar year. And then they open up throughout the year as people go on and off of them. But so they're not just like they're always there. And then your last choice is waiving the copay. Can you do that? And that's kind of what Mike was talking about, that, you know, we ended up with a couple patients going, well, you know, if we can afford it, can we waive their copay, you know? And traditionally with commercial insurance, you could, or a cash pay, you could. But Medicare, we were always told, you could not. So I decided to kind of start thinking about that a little bit because, you know, I had to be nosy. And I went through some Medicare laws to find out if that was really true. Slide, please. So I'll tell you more about that. But I wanted to also show you, here's an example for this is one of our actual patients. This is Jane Doe. She's actually an oncology patient. This is exactly what her bill looked like. I took this right out of our system. So just as an example, the details of the numbers don't necessarily matter as much as if you, what you can see is that she goes through every one of these stages in Medicare in 1 month. So her deductible, her initial benefit, the donut hole, and puts her into catastrophic coverage in one fill because her drug is $17,000. So the insurance pays that $12,769, and then her out-of-pocket really is $2,645 for 1 month. So this is what kind of prompted that. Well, can we, this is a Medicare D patient, can we waive that copay or not? What do we do about this? That's a big chunk of change. Slide, please. So in her case, I was able to find a grant. I will start with those. I mean, you know, my best interest is to look for grants first before writing something off. And the Healthful Fund is great. There's a couple that I use, but they gave her $3,500. But you can see from her $2,600 bill that got chewed through, you know, in the first month and a half. I put her on a waiting list, and then we got her another grant. So far, we're still working off the second one. So she was great. She was very grateful and really, really grateful just to Jefferson Healthcare overall. She felt like she was always really taken care of, and this was just an extension of that. So so she's good for hers. So that's sort of an example of how a grant can help. Next slide, please. And just a side note, so all these grants are private. This is nothing that comes from the state. It's not from the manufacturer either. Those are the main four that I use. They all work about the same, and they all have about the same rules. But just to be clear, it's different than a manufacturer grant. It's a private grant. Slide, please. Okay, so I had to figure out in situations like hers, because I had other ones where I didn't have any grants, can we waive a copay? So I don't expect you to read all the fine print there. That's actually a little excerpt from about 40 pages of Medicare law that I read. But what's important about it is that the answer was yes. And that the highlighted part is that pharmacies are permitted to waive or reduce Part D cost sharing amounts, provided they do so in unadvertised and non-routine manner. So we could do it as long as we didn't advertise it, and as long as we just didn't do it all the time without even reviewing each patient. And I felt like I had found gold. I was so excited. We actually might be able to waive to help people get their specialty prescriptions without sending them away, because I had been starting to send certain people away, and I'm like, oh, this is not going to end well. But then I had the second issue, of course, of can we afford to do it? Because our first goal is to help patients, but, you know, we have to keep the lights on. So slide, please. So I dug around in that a little bit. Sorry, that slide might be out of order there. Apologize. I'll just tell you about this one. What's important about it is that because we're a critical access hospital, we're also a safety net pharmacy. So being a safety net pharmacy, it allows us to participate in a couple of things like the 340B program, which I will touch on slightly. Again, this is a whole part of a big law. I don't expect you to read all of that. But what makes us a safety net pharmacy is important. It means that you deliver a significant level of health care and other health-related services to uninsured and vulnerable patients. And it includes small rural hospitals and critical access hospitals. Being a safety net pharmacy was important, which is probably why I put that right after Part D, because it's part of what allows you to waive a copay for Part D. You're allowed to do it if you are a safety net pharmacy. Slide, please. So this is also a big program, something that's, that my good friend Kim Thornton could tell you about much better, and she could have a whole half hour just on the 340B program. But what's important to know, if you're not familiar with it, is, you know, Jefferson Healthcare participates in this program because of our critical access status as well. What's important in this slide is that, you know, this drug pricing program, you know, it makes our drug costs so much lower. And when it says it allows us to buy things at a significantly discounted price, that is an understatement. Now, it's not a set percentage. I can't tell you, like, it's always 30% off or it's always 50% off. It really varies because it depends on the manufacturer, because they're actually passing along that that price break. But some things are 50%. Some things are much more than 50%. So that gives you a little buffer if you can buy something at a lower cost. It isn't just retail. It is all of our inpatient pharmaceuticals, like the infusion center, ACU, surgery, all of that goes through and filters through the 340B program. As well, we have like some contract pharmacies like Safeway, QFC, Don's, as well as our own in Port Ludlow. And those become pharmacies that are also able to purchase at that reduced rate. So since we're on that list, even though we're independent in Port Ludlow, we were able to use this program to help patients. So now I felt like I had my other piece, right? Maybe we can afford it. Maybe I have the go-ahead from Medicare, which I did also call Medicare in Seattle and make sure I understood that right. We have the go-ahead from Medicare, and then we were able to possibly afford to do it. Slide, please. The one piece of participating in the 340B program that I think is so great is that it is required that the money that you save goes back into the community. That is part of what makes it so great. I call it paying it forward. I'm sure there's a technical term in their laws, but it's this is just one more way to do that. And we do it already. I mean, we do it with our uncompensated care at, you know, through the financial department. We do it through the dental clinic, as well as now our waivers out in Port Ludlow. You know, things like the dental clinic have a huge value, even if you don't always see it monetarily. They're not supposed to make money in that way. Like, they're supposed to be there to pay it forward, to allow these other programs that fund other things. So anyway, just remember that when the dental clinic needs something, we have to treat them as good as oncology. So all those kind of like, they're all moving parts that work together. And this is just one more way that we can pay it forward. I get asked sometimes, is 340B or a patient that comes through Port Ludlow, you know, are they a 340B patient? No, 340B is not patient specific. It's not like we give just certain patients 10% off or 20% off. Participating in the program makes it so that the facility qualifies for 340B, if that makes sense. And then you can choose where that savings is going to go. So just to make that clear, it's not patient specific. It goes more toward the facility, and then we can do things like this. Slide, please. So this is ours. This is what we came up with after I read the law a whole bunch, and after I found out, yes, we could afford to do it. I basically copied this off of the way people apply for grants. It was better that way, because then if somebody qualified for a grant, they also qualified for assistance from us. There was no picking and choosing what they qualified for. It's also very simple. It doesn't cause like a delay in care with people trying to round up all of their bills. So this is just the basic formula that I use for everyone. And this is, again, just if someone has insurance. Based on their household size and income, and max of 500% of federal poverty level. That's kind of the simplest. And then it's good for 12 months. Slide, please. So one more example for you, because examples are the best, because there are real people. John Doe was an ACU discharge patient. And this one, this scenario, I mean, I probably get a phone call or two a week from the ACU with this. So Eliquis for him, one of the DOACs for anticoag. And, you know, they're always about $600 a month. So this is really what was billed. He really had this much left of his deductible benefit and copay. So his out-of-pocket cost that came out on the slip was $227. Slide, please. So for John, he qualified for the copay waiver as opposed to a grant. There aren't a lot of grants for DOAC, so that was a problem that I kind of had. But I'm happy to say that that's one of the drugs. Both Eliquis and Xarelto are the two that we get from the ACU a lot. Those are some of the least expensive drugs that we can buy. We get those. It's such a reduced rate that you can almost help. I haven't had to say no to anybody yet. So that was the answer for Joe. We did do a copay waiver for him, and that will be good for 12 months also. Next slide, please. And I just want to touch in on uncompensated care. That's the one where I said, you know, if somebody has no insurance or anything else, it's usually very low income patients, ER or homeless. We do have a couple of different homeless people that have come out a couple of times. And one was the gentleman that I said was living at the homeless shelter downtown, who had his medication stolen, is an example of that. And those are ones that we're also able to just write off, because the difference between what we can charge insurance and what we can purchase the drug for is great enough to allow things like this to fit in there too. Slide, please. So I do want to show you a couple of totals, because this is, you know, this is the exciting part. So right now, our total for our copay assistance, we have helped 41 patients. And again, the majority is oncology. Then the DOACs, inhaler, and insulin. Our average value of 340B just for these 41 patients, so not the whole pharmacy, but just these 41, is about $92.50 a month. And by value, I mean that's what we have to work with after we have billed the insurance and, you know, paid the bill for the drugs. So the average amount we waive is about $6,000 of that. It isn't the same every month, because obviously need changes a little bit. But even that would be about $72,000 a year that we're able to waive. And then I did put the income in there as $3,250 after. And even though $39,000 a year doesn't sound like a lot, I know you guys work with a lot of really big numbers. For 41 patients and for being able to waive that many, that's a lot, especially in retail pharmacy right now, where people are barely making their drug costs. We're covering our costs, helping people, and still having some left over there. Slide, please. And then our total for our grants, it's actually 16. I got one more this morning. So we have, we have 15 grants, 13 patients, because a couple of patients got more than one grant. Again, a lot to oncology. coupled to asthma and one hepatic encephalopathy. And that $98,000 is from January 1st. And that's really exciting. I was really excited about that. All of that, you know, is the same private funding that it has no strings attached. You know, they just give it right to the patient, and that we hold, and we just use every grant to sort of pay off their co-pays, and it's good for up to a year. We can pull from it for up to a year. So really excited about the grants too. Slide, please. So that is pretty much everything that we have at our pharmacy right now. I'm going to leave this up there in case somebody does know, like a patient that does need help. I'm really excited about these programs, and patients really are too. I mean, I can't tell you how many thank yous that we get, how much people talk about how they appreciate that Jefferson Healthcare remembers everybody in Port Ludlow, or remembers that people are struggling right now. So just passing that along, I get a lot of thank yous. And anyway, I hope you're excited about that. Thank you for having me.
Well, now let me add to the thank yous on behalf of the community. I really truly admire your tenacity in getting the information and putting the work and effort into getting help for our patients that need it. Thank you so much. Great report.
Yeah, sure. We have great patients. We have really great patients.
Any other comments?
Way to go, Nell. Perfect.
Thanks.
Your great face of Jefferson Healthcare Pharmacy in particular, absolutely, you're doing such a good job for our patients. And like Jill said, tenacity. Persistence pays is my personal mantra, and I can see you've got it too.
Right, that's that. Getting to yes. How do we get to yes?
Perfect.
Yeah, Nell's philosophy is clearly getting to yes, ask for forgiveness later. And I'm looking at all the directors on this call right now, and I'm thinking,
uh-oh.
But it's great work, and truly that I've been involved in the 340B program for, you know, almost 11 years just here, and it is super confusing. Noel and Lanny and a few other folks in the department have not only understand it, but I think they really maximize it for Jefferson Healthcare and our community's benefit.
Yeah, and there definitely are different ways to maximize it once you take the time to learn how it works. For sure.
Great job. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Go to our second education topic, which is an update on home health and hospice from the Executive Director, Tammy Tarsa. Mike, do you have any comments that you'd like to make at the beginning?
Well, just how proud we are of home health and hospice and the incredible work that they are doing. They recently went through a rigorous accreditation process and came out with flying colors. And I think that that what we are going through in with COVID-19 is a challenge for everyone. And I think so much of the focus tends to land on the hospital, but our home health and hospice employees are also in a really, really challenging spot, and yet they are out there easing transitions from the hospital to the home and doing an amazing job. So I'm looking forward to Tammy's presentation to give you an idea of what's new with the program. So Tammy Tarsa, take it away.
Thank you very much. And before I get started, I just want to say Anel passed over the pharmacy's role in our hospice program, but they play a huge piece as a hospice benefit covers all of the medications related to a patient's terminal diagnosis or prognosis. And when you look at the number of medications that patients have, it's a really long list a lot of times. And so by utilizing our Port Ludlow Pharmacy, the 340B, we're able to minimize the cost, which really helps the bottom line of our program. And Nell is a peach to work with. So just additional kudos for Nell and the pharmacy there in Port Ludlow. They are most excellent to work with. So as I move on to my presentation, this is just a reminder that you, as our commissioners, are our governing board. So we are mandated by Medicare regulation to have a governing board, and you, lucky individuals, are it for us. And so I am required to provide an update on a regular basis. And the way we have chosen to interpret regular means quarterly. And so I'm going to try to be in person two of those times, and then the other two, I will just send an update. So the last one was an update that was in your packet, and this time you get me. So we'll get started. Please feel free to ask any questions as we go. All right, next slide, please. So I'm going to try to give just a really short review of what each program is as we go through. So our hospice program is for terminally ill patients, and our goal is to provide comfort care for them. Patients can, when we say terminal, the Medicare regulation says 6 months or less, but we have a woman that just has been on 2 years as of yesterday. So certainly our patients can be on for longer. In fact, research shows that when patients are on hospice, they actually live longer because that we take such good care of them. But that's hospice comfort care at end of life. Next slide, please. So just to recap, we did go through accreditation, and they showed up in July. We had been planning for that accreditation for almost a year, and it was a lot of work, and our staff stepped up and really did the work that needed to be done. Certainly, there was a lot of back-end work with policies and procedures, but when push comes to shove, it's the frontline staff that really feels the burden of implementing the changes and changing their practice in order to meet not only Medicare regulation, but ACHC standards, which is just one step up from Medicare regulations. And they did an amazing job. So our accrediting body, which is ACHC, Accreditation Commission for Home Care, I'm sorry, for healthcare. They came on Monday, July 12th. So they spent 3 days in our office. While they were here, they reviewed 13 patient charts. They completed 3 home visits. They reviewed our QAPI program, reviewed policies and procedures. And just as a side note with the policies and procedures, we did complete our policies and we sent them off for what we call a desk review. So they previewed them first and sent them back to us. So we knew where our deficiencies were as far as our policies were concerned right away. And so we had an opportunity to fix those. And those are the ones they reviewed when they came. They reviewed 13 personnel files, reviewed contracts, reviewed infection control program, and reviewed our emergency management plan. When all was said and done, next slide, please. When all was said and done, we were cited on 4 things, 2 of which were out of the same standard. And the way Medicare works is if you have 3 deficiencies out of 1 standard, it is a higher ding for you. And so most often, while our survey was pending until we had a plan of correction, it would have been a deficiency had we received 1 more, and they would have had to come back to resurvey. That was just education because that didn't happen to us. We just had 2 and it was all just fine. And these were the sightings for us. And as it turns out, one of the sightings ended up in 2 different standards. And so that was also kind of a coinky dink for us. So one was medication profile. We had all of the medications that our patients are on are to be in their medication list. And our medication list is often different than the list that's in hyperspace. So let me back up just one step. So we use Epic. We are in Epic, so we're integrated with the hospital system. However, we are on a different platform. So hyperspace, the mothership, that's the Epic that the hospital uses. And we use a remote client. So most of our information transitions over into the hospital system so that people can see it, but not all of the information from the hospital system transfers over into our remote client. It's really weird, and my personal opinion is that whoever created it didn't have a clue what they were doing, but it is what we have, and there are some good things. So, but one of the challenges are the medication profiles. So we are to update our medication profile, and we did not do as good a job as we needed to. So that was one of our citations. Individualized plan of care. We had one of 13 that we did not have an individualized plan of care. Oxygen route. So this is this was our two sightings in one standard. You'll see it was HSP 5-4A. So the oxygen route, and this was an epic build situation. And so we have found a workaround moving forward, but quite honestly, if the surveyors hadn't come and found it, we would have been missing it from here to who knows when. So when an order is put in for oxygen, it automatically comes with inhalation as the route. And that is not specific enough for us. So we want to be able to change that route, but we do not have the ability to do so. So the workaround that we are now doing is in patient instructions, we're saying 2 to 4 liters per nasal cannula or whatever the actual route is. So that was the correction we made. We did put a ticket into Epic, but they were unable to make that change. So we're just going to utilize that workaround for this at this point. And then infection control. We had one break in infection control in our home visit. So the plan of correction was accepted, and so we're good to go. All of the initial work that needed to be done in order to be compliant has been done, and we are now going to move forward with doing the audits. The accreditation cycles for hospice from August 9th, 2021 to August 9th, 2024. So all in all, it was a very successful survey. And I will say we had a Department of Health survey in the early spring, and that was extremely helpful because some of the things that we were cited on for the Department of Health survey, we were able to correct. And when they mentioned those things in this survey, we magically had it ready for them. So when they came in the spring, it was a moment of panic, but as it turned out, it was the best thing that could have happened for us. So that was really good. Next slide, please. So we have been very fortunate to receive a couple very generous gifts. We have one gift of $12,000 that came into us. And with that gift, we have been able to purchase some Rojo cushions, which are some really nice cushions that can go in the seat of wheelchairs, in the seat of recliners, to help protect patients' skin and avoid pressure ulcers. And so those we are able to just give to patients and they keep those. And then a bladder scanner is another item that we are looking at purchasing. And so those will be really helpful to our patients. This same donor gifted us monies last year as well. And with those, we have purchased PCAs. And I'm going to get to that in just a second. The most recent gift was a donation of $90,000. And they were very specific in how they asked for those monies to be dispensed. And so we have chosen to... So they wanted 50% to go to bereavement, 25% of it to go to comfort therapies, and 25% to our staff. So how we have opted to use that, the comfort therapy, we're going to increase the amount and variety of comfort therapies that we have. Currently, we have a cellist, and we have some music therapy, and we have a couple massage therapists. So we're looking at maybe some pet, maybe some touch therapy, just some different options for our patients, and that will be funded through this donation. We're also looking at adding a new position to our hospice group. It would be a 0.6 FTE bereavement and spiritual care support person. So we have Christina, and she's absolutely wonderful, but she is completely maxed. And so what we've had to eliminate from our program is the focus on our community bereavement. In the past, we have offered bereavement services to community members, regardless of whether they have been on hospice or not. And we've had to step back from that just due to capacity. So this position would allow us to put that focus back on our community members and offer those services to them, in addition to providing additional support for our hospice if Christina's out and so on. So that will be really great. And then education, with those monies, we are looking at offering a seminar to our staff. So all of our staff would attend and it would be free of charge, and then opening it up also to Assured Hospice as well as potential hospital staff. And it's certification for hospice and palliative care nurses. And so it would just be a really good educational opportunity. There's a considerable cost normally to staff to take that, not only to take the education to prepare for it, but also to take the exam itself. So with this donation, we'll be able to offer that to our staff, and that will be a great benefit to them. And then we also then will provide, we have monies to provide individual patient needs as they arise. So we have patients who can't afford to buy briefs. And so those types of things we pay for out of these gifted monies. CPAP equipment, just odds and ends, things that show up that people need help with. Next slide, please. So patient-controlled analgesics. So as I mentioned, last year, we were also gifted with a donation, and we made the decision to move forward with purchasing 3 PCA pumps. The benefit to having, and that's patient-controlled analgesics, it's an infused type of pain medication, which will allow for us to keep patients at home more frequently rather than send them to the hospital when their oral pain medications don't work. The benefits of that are multiple. Number one, it keeps patients in their home. And most patients on hospice, they choose hospice because they want to die in their home. Number two, it provides a better way for us to manage those pain medications rather than trying all of the different pain medications and layering them. We can go to this this option right away and hopefully alleviate that burden on the family, who is often the one who's trying to help us manage that. Three, it will keep patients out of the hospital. And that will be a really good thing. Often we're looking at bed capacity when we have a patient that needs to come in. General inpatient, GIP is our terminology. And so we'll help keep patients out of the hospital. So it's really a win-win-win situation, and really looking forward to moving forward with this. We're looking at a mid-September go live. Our protocols have been written, our policies are written, medications have been attained. We're working to purchase the sub-Q buttons that are needed. Hospice nurses actually had their education today, so they are fully ready to go. And what's holding us up now is educating the home health staff, because they often work on call, and so they need that education too. So it's all kind of in process. But I think one of the great things, other than being able to provide our patients with this added service, it's the fact that this has been a real collaborative effort. So I've worked really closely with Lanny and Nell in the pharmacy. We've worked with clinical informatics. Michelle has been really great in helping us develop the protocols and getting that into the Epic system so that we can use that. And Elena in purchasing to help us get the equipment, the additional equipment we need in order to put these products into patients' homes. So really a great team effort to benefit our community, and that's always nice to see as well. Next slide, please. General update, so just touching on a few things. From January to July, our census has bounced around from 32 to 48. So at one point we were as high as 48, and then we've come back down. Today our census at 32. So it's been a little bit of a roller coaster. Volunteers are still not able to go into patients' homes. I keep thinking that any day we're going to get the go-ahead, and as soon as I think that, COVID rebounds and we're back to square one. So our volunteers are trained and chomping at the bit to go back in, and hopefully that will happen. You know, I'd love to say the end of this year, but I don't know if that's true. One of the waivers, the COVID waivers that have come out, and they have been in place since COVID started, was that our volunteer, so hospice is required that 5% of all hours of care provided are given by volunteers, and that has been waived. So that's a good thing for us. Hospice Foundation, just letting you know that our Hospice Foundation is in flux. We have 3 people moving off of the board in September, and so we are looking for new board members to come on board. We have a meeting tomorrow, and it looks like we have 2 potential new board members, so that's really great. But if you have any friends who are interested in getting involved in a really great a great board, our Hospice Foundation is looking for some. So I pass that along to you. And then just a quick note on our budget. We have been doing really well in hospice. In part, that is due to our higher census. And in part, as I said, we have this one patient has been on 2 years. So if we can extend the days on hospice, that really helps with our financials. And so that's been really good for us. So our revenues are at 85% budget as of 6 months, and then our expenses are at 42%. So that's been good. Oh, and one other thing that I didn't put on the slide, but I wanted to mention, CMS is changing the way they look at quality scores. So we have been utilizing and still are utilizing HIS, HIS. It's Hospice Item Set, and they are transitioning to what they call HOPE. And I wish I could tell you what H-O-P-E stands for, but I just can't. Anyway, we offered to beta test that HOPE line, and they approved us. So we are going to start beta testing that for CMS in October. It'll be really good for us, number one, to have input into policy whenever we can have a voice in what's happening. That's really good. But also it gives us a leg up when we actually move forward with it, because it will, moving forward, be our quality indicator for patients. Next slide, please. So home health. The focus on home health is providing medical care to homebound patients who have a skilled need. So patients must have a skilled need, and they must not be able to leave their home unless it's taxing an effort and requires the assistance of a device or a person. So it's a little bit gray. Actually, it's a lot of it gray. So I'm not going to get into the details, but that's the generalization for home health. So one of the great things, next slide please, that happened most recently for home health is that we have a home health manager. Yay! So we have been living without a home health manager for 8 months, no, 7 months, I lied, 7 months. And so it's really great. Andrea is here and she is wonderful, wonderful. If you ever have an opportunity to talk with her, please take it because she's just amazing. She does not come to us with home health experience, but she comes to us with a lot of leadership experience, and that's what this team needed. And she's just doing an amazing job. I'm really excited for the future of the program. Next slide, please. So we are moving forward with accreditation for home health. Now that we have hospice and palliative care done, once we have home health, that will be the entire foundation for our program, and we can start building on additional service lines from there. But we really need to tackle home health accreditation first. So we have a pretty aggressive timeline, and I'm going to be really honest and say that with everything that's happening right now with COVID and staffing, that this timeline may be pushed back just because our priorities have to be shifted someplace else. But, you know, if I choose to be positive in any good moment, I can also say, well, if we have fewer staff and fewer patients, we have more time to actually train. And the fewer people you have to train, the more apt it is to stick, the better we can. So, you know, it depends on where I'm at. If I'm feeling pessimistic or optimistic, kind of debates on where I fall with this timeline. But I think it could go either way. And this is the plan as of right now. So we plan on having a kickoff celebration September 13 with our staff. We thought it was really important that we gave at least the staff, we've been working on it in administration, but that we give at least the staff an opportunity to take a break, take a breather between hospice accreditation and home health. But September 13th, we're going to officially kick it off. We hope to have all our policies reviewed by November 19th. We are in Section 5, and there are 7 standards to go through, so we're moving along. November 30th is beginning to roll out the education. OASIS training on December 31st, more training. We hope to send the desk review in along with our accreditation application on January 31st and call for the survey on April 1st so that they would come between the months of April and May. So again, it's aggressive, and we'll see how we end up landing. The next update I give you will probably have a better idea of that. Next slide, please. So general updates, similar to hospice, our census has bounced around. We have been at 68 to 99 over the last 6 months. If we were to go back to 2019, when that's our last really actual picture of what we could be doing, we were at a census of 120, and that was our average. So I think that there is every reason that we can get back there. We just haven't seen it happen yet. So when we hit 100, I will be doing the happy dance here in the office for sure. Budget, we are at 40% of our expected revenues. Part of that is our lower census for sure. Part of that is the payment model, and I'm going to speak just a little bit to that at the four-day IDG. And then we're at 50% of expected expenses. And while we are over expenses, yes, part of the overage in expenses is the way our staffing is allocated between the two programs, home health and hospice. We're pretty fluid here in our department. And so when we switch a nurse to one program or the other, they don't always get moved. So part of that deficit in the expenses is people are not earmarked correctly. And we hope to fix that with the next budget. So the four-day IDG, the way the home health payment model works is they look at an equation, and CMS has built this equation, and they're looking at the diagnosis and comorbidities. They are looking at whether this patient, the referral is coming from a facility or the referral is coming from a community. They are looking at whether this is the first referral or whether this is what we call a recertification. So they've been on our services in the past. And so they take all of that and they say, based on all of this information, we're going to pay you. Oh, and they also look at a function level. So how do we score a patient based on the assessment? Do they need a lot of help or a little bit of help? And so based on all of that, they roll it up, spit it out, and they come up with a payment model. And within that payment, we are to pay for all of our services, for all of our disciplines, and all of our supplies. DME and medication is not included in that, but everything else is. And so one of the things that we have been focusing on is really looking at what that payment is going to be. We have an estimation through a system that we work with, and looking to see if what we think this patient needs is viable within the resources that our program says that we are going to receive from CMS. And oftentimes it's not, you know, oftentimes the reimbursement is 200 or 2000 and we do 10 visits at 250 a visit, you're looking at 2500 and that doesn't even include supplies. So we're really focusing on that four-day IDG and can we pay for our services with the resources that we're going to be given? Sometimes it's a hard no, we can't. And a patient just needs us, but that should be the exception. And we need to make sure that the other times it's yes, so that we have that extra to pay for those ones that are no. So really focusing hard on that four-day IDG. Next slide, please. So palliative care. So palliative care is a specialized care for people living with serious illness and health conditions. The focus of this care is symptom management with a goal of improving quality of life. So a lot of times these patients are also on home health. A lot of times these patients are hospice appropriate, but for whatever reason, they're not willing to accept that hospice diagnosis. And so we give them to palliative care, and palliative care then works with these patients, manages the symptoms, and transitions them on to hospice, or alleviates, you know, helps them manage the symptoms so they can come off palliative care. So that's our palliative care program. It is brand new. We hired Renee in January, and so she first started seeing patients in March. And that program is also fully accredited. So on Thursday, July 15th, the surveyors were here. They reviewed 5 patient charts, completed 1 home visit, 3 personnel files. And again, they looked at our QAPI emergency management policies, infection control. And then the interesting thing about the palliative care program accreditation is it's brand new. So ACHC, our surveyors, they just rolled this program out in May. So this is one of the reasons our accreditation was delayed, is because we were waiting to do the palliative care accreditation. And so they asked a lot of questions about the program itself and what we were doing, what were some of the challenges. And so that was some really great conversation and we learned a lot from them. And in the end, it was really successful. We did have 2 sightings, medication profile and oxygen route. And the oxygen route is the same situation that I spoke with on the hospice survey. It was the route of the oxygen. It was inhalation, and we needed to put that it was nasal cannula. And so, again, we have made that correction. And the cycle dates are 8-2-2021 to 8-2-2024. So, yay. General updates. Current census is 19. She has 3 more scheduled. Oh, I'm sorry. Could you? One more. I have notes on my slide, so sorry. So census is currently 19 and we have three more scheduled. I was talking with Renee just prior to logging in for this meeting. And, you know, one of the benefits of palliative care, and when I looked at the budget moving forward and the revenues, not only did I budget in the, you know, the revenues that Renee herself as an ARNP would bring in from being able to bill for those, but there was a backdoor revenue that came into play also, and that was for the hospice patients. If we can increase the length of stay for our hospice patients, it increases our revenues for hospice, which is part of what we're seeing when we look at our budget and our 82% of budget at 6 months in. And so she was telling me that she has four patients turning over, transitioning to hospice in the next week. And a couple of those are going to have a long length of stay. And she was bemoaning that because it's sad to be turning them over into hospice. But I said, Renee, you're doing a great job. That's exactly what the program is supposed to do. Good work. So that's really good to hear. It's nice when a plan comes together, right? So that was good. The other piece of that transition plan was that she would go into those patients' homes who were ready for hospice physically, medically, but maybe weren't quite ready for hospice emotionally. You know, that word hospice can have some real negative connotations and can elicit fear in some patients and family members. So Renee goes in, we get a palliative care referral. Renee goes in and she can start having those conversations and start building that relationship of trust. And then when that those patients transition to hospice, she can remain as their provider, as the attending, and that is what's happening. So many of those patients that transition from palliative care to hospice are utilizing Renee as the attending provider, which again is a plan coming together. So she's doing a really, really wonderful job. We have budgeted for an MA position in 2022 to increase her efficiency. That will be really important for us moving forward in order to add patients to her load. Next slide, please. So departmentally, we look at all three of our programs, home health, hospice, and palliative care. Next slide, please. And just some general information. Our department is not like any of the other departments in the hospital right now. Staffing is in crisis situations for us. So some of the positive things around staffing is that we have 24/7 staffing. It gives us improved availability and quality of care. So those things are really good. We've added a community liaison to go out and start doing some education to our community, to our providers, to our referral sources. So that is a really good thing. Challenges are staffing. We just don't have enough. We need staffing. We need nurses. And then what we're doing is we're looking at creative staffing. So I actually have a meeting after this to start looking at what are some other options. I've posted some OT and PT positions that would potentially replace a nursing position. And whichever position I get filled first will be the winner. And that's the one we'll run with. So it's that type of thing. We're looking closely at discipline scopes. How can we utilize telehealth more vigorously so that we can gain some visits that way? And who do we have that we could utilize differently? Really looking at our aides with our lower census, they are not as busy. So looking at their scope and looking at creative ways that we could utilize them, even if it's not even in an aide capacity, giving care, but what could we do that would help our nurses so they could be more efficient with their time? So those are the things that we're looking at, and we'll see where the dice lie when we get all done. Confident we'll get through it. This is not the first staffing crisis we've been in, but it sure does make for a difficult working environment. I talked to Tina on Monday. God bless Tina. She's amazing. Just so you know, Tina Toner is amazing. You know, I had a moment of panic as I was getting texts over the weekend about staff that were going to be out. That moment of panic, you know, where your heart beats just a little bit faster and you have to make sure you take a deep breath or you don't know what's going to happen. That's where I was. And my thought was, what am I doing in healthcare? Why did I choose healthcare? You know, and you get past that moment, you take those deep breaths and you move on to the next thing and you get back to that why, which is taking care of people. But but it's really hard. It's really hard. And I know that you know that. And we will get through it. That's what I tell my staff. We will get through this. We've been here before, but it's tough. All right, moving on, because we have some good stuff going on. So next slide, please. So one of the things that we heard loud and clear when we did our last survey with our staff was that our orientation program was really bad. And they were right, our orientation was really bad. And so we have worked hard through accreditation to build an orientation program that not only meets our needs, but hopefully is a little bit more interactive for the staff themselves. And so we created an orientation monopoly board, and you can't see the pieces, but what we did is we went through all of the pieces of orientation. What do our clinicians absolutely need to know in order to work in the field? And then we put them in an order, and then we made a monopoly board out of it. So far, we've had, I think, 4 people go through it. You can see we have 3 almost to the end. And we've tried to intersperse it with a little bit of fun. So there's a grab bag. There's a clean car inspection. And if they pass the clean car inspection, they get an air freshener. There's a, you know, we have gift certificates, so we buy a coffee for them. So some interactive pieces. And it's not all one person doing the orientation. Each of the leadership team has a portion of the orientation program that they do. They have checklists that they have to complete with the employees. We have weekly meetings with their direct supervisor built in. So it's really good. So the next piece we're working on is that second phase, because this is just what do you absolutely need to know to go into the field. That next piece is what do you really need to know to be effective and efficient in your job. So that is a goal of 2022, which is a perfect segue to looking ahead. We did meet as a leadership team to start looking at our thoughts for 2022. And I'm not going to go through each one verbatim, but we are looking at how we can more integrate fully with Jefferson Healthcare. It's really important to us that we are a collaborative partner with the hospital. Being a 25-bed critical access hospital, they are sometimes dependent on getting patients out so they can bring new patients in. And we recognize our part in that. So how can we be a better partner to them? We want to be a great place to work. If we want staff to be here, then we really need to toe the line. And so what can we do to be a great place to work? Next slide, please. We want to have satisfied patients with excellent outcomes. This is really important. We had hoped to be 5-star by the end of my 3rd-year tenure, and we bumped it down to 4-star rating. And so we're hoping to get to 4 stars by the end of 2022. We want to be fully accredited in home health. And so we're working on that. Again, meeting community need. We had hoped to have an increased census, and just reality check is that we're hoping to be back to our 29 standards. That's what we're hoping for. We do have a very robust quality and compliance, and then financially viable. It's important that we're contributing to the hospital's bottom line. So that's a priority for us, but also that our AR, we do all of our own billing in-house. And so we want to be down to 45 AR days. And our last slide, please. And then we do have some initiatives that we would like to see move forward, and we'll see where we get on these. Again, a lot of it depends on what the end of this year looks like and the beginning of next year looks like, and then working with the foundation to have some potentially increased funds for our patients. All right, I think I have 1 minute to spare. Any Thank questions?
You. Thank you, Tammy. That was an excellent report. I have one question, if I may. Do we have more demand that we can meet in these programs?
We do have more demand than we can meet, yes. Were we fully staffed, the answer would be no. We would be able to meet the demand. But right now, with our staffing, we are really looking at who can we admit. So one of the things that we're looking at is an acuity model. In fact, that's what my next meeting is about. And really, we're going to take high acuity patients because we know that that's going to be the best partnership with the hospital, helping move them out of the hospital and keep them out of the hospital. But what that's going to do is it's going to limit the number of patients we can bring on our services just by visits. So we're looking at what are the total number of visits that we can do in a week. High acuity patients take a little bit longer, so that means we can see even less patients. So really finding the right balance, because we have great staff that work here, great frontline staff, and they have been through the ringer over the last 18 months, and I am bound and determined to not kill them off, because what's even worse than not having any new staff is losing the old staff that we do have. So when we're looking at bringing patients on, I'm trying to balance the need of serving the community with also maintaining the staffing levels that I do have right now. And it really is, it's a fine walk. And I know that my department's not any different than any other department in that. I just happen to live in my department, so that's what I'm most vocal about.
Thank you, Tammy. Mm-hmm. Any other questions, comments?
Excellent, comprehensive report. Thank you so much for everything you guys do over there. And I did get the chance to bump into Andrea about her second week here. She was driving her vehicle with out of state plates, and yes. I commented to her in the parking lot. She seems to be a great asset to your services. Thank you.
Yeah, she's wonderful. I can't say enough good things about her. Yeah.
Thanks, Tammy. Very good report and very informative. Thank you. Yeah.
You're welcome. And I'll see you in 6 months or so. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Then we will now recess until 3:30. Thank you. Well, welcome back to the business portion of the August 25th Jefferson County Public Hospital District No. 2 Board of Commissioners meeting. And before we begin, there's one person here who's doing an awfully lot of work, and without whose help, we'd really be hard-pressed to have this meeting, and that's Alyssa Rodriguez, our administrative assistant. So, Alyssa, thank you for doing such a good job for us.
Here, here.
All right. So we will begin with Chief Nursing Officer Tina Toner with a patient story. Thank you.
Thank you, Jill. Good afternoon. So it's always heartwarming to share patient stories with you. And I think what I like best about them is every time I share a story, a fantastic patient story is always because someone from one of our teams did something just above and beyond for a patient. You know, they hit it out of the park, they gave of themselves, they were there for a patient on one of the patient's worst days. And today I decided to do a bit of a takeover on the patient story and share one of my own patient stories. So I've been thinking a lot about my time here at Jefferson Healthcare because next week actually will be my 3-year anniversary. And
wow.
I realized that half of that time, 18 months, I've spent in a COVID world. And, you know, I've been a nurse for 26 years and I've seen a lot of things in that time, and there's been many challenges along the way. And when COVID started, I remember, you know, having the sense and talking to the team that, you know, this really feels like this is going to be a defining moment in many of our careers. And I can tell you with certainty it has been. You know, we've asked so much of our team, and especially in these last few months, they have been a hard few months. You know, we're seeing more and more patients with COVID. We've had significant challenges with staffing. Our patients are sicker, and many of our patients are struggling emotionally. And we're facing tremendous amounts of change, you know, every single day in how we treat patients, how we deliver care, how we structure our departments, how we navigate changing protocols like visitation, how we use technology, really everything about how we get through, you know, each day changes frequently. And all the while, you know, all of us have that life outside of these walls. You know, we have families we care for. We have people we're worried about, and we carry the weight of the world on our shoulders, just like everyone else. So the last few months really have been the hardest of my career, but I think one of the reasons that that's really true for me is because I have never, as a leader, asked so much of my team. You know, I've never asked or expected anyone to do what this team has done again and again. you know, they've just risen to the occasion over and over again for months. And in every hard day and every hard shift, you know, no matter what has been asked, they are still those people behind our patient's story. You know, they're their team. Our team does not let each other down. They don't let their patients down. They come in extra. They come in early. They stay late. They give and they give. And they are still doing all those little things that matter to our patients. I was rounding the last couple of days and hearing little stories and, you know, just hearing about the things that those little touches of TLC that our team is so, you know, known for. Things like, you know, we had a patient that just loves the cornbread. And so they are making sure that every day he gets the cornbread because that reminds him of his childhood. And, you know, they're going back one more time with the warm blanket and tucking someone before bed and, you know, having those moments of conversation and looking someone in the eye. And, you know, they're still hurting for our patients and hurting with our patients. And they will do those one more things, you know, even when there's 100 other things going on. And even when that means, you know, their day doesn't end when it's supposed to. So today I just wanted to take a moment and dedicate this patient's story to that team, my team, and thank them for all that they do and have been doing for many months. And just acknowledge that they continue to be there for our patients on their worst days, even, you know, when they're experiencing some of the toughest days they've ever experienced in healthcare. And while we're not alone in this struggle, we are different in that nobody else has this team, and I'm so proud to work with them. I'm so proud to serve as their leader, and just a big, huge thank you to that team.
Well, Gina, that's the most inspirational and warm report that I've ever heard from you, and I really thank you for that. I think you embody the sentiments of all of us on the board, and we can all speak for ourselves. If anyone else want to add anything?
Well, Tina, as a retired nurse, retired RN, gosh, it wouldn't have been a fantastic role for me to work under you with your leadership. You really are such a great asset to us and to the staff, the nursing staff. They know that they've got a supreme leader, and thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
They inspire, this team inspires you to work as hard as you can every day because of how hard they're working. And I really am proud to work with them.
You know, nobody signed up for all of this, and a measure of a person really is how they work through these things. And our people have just been stellar, mm-hmm. just stellar. And you are so busy working, all of you, all of the staff, that you don't maybe come out in the community and hear the things that we hear about our staff. If I could bring every single comment, they're all compliments, wonderful comments. I was at a car show outside and socially distancing on Saturday, and I heard nothing but wonderful comments about our staff and our hospital system. And they were so proud to have Jefferson Healthcare and the people that work here. They all say the staff is so wonderful. They don't talk about the building. They talk about the people.
Yeah.
And thank you, all of you, for that. So then we will go on now to the minutes. Could I have a motion to approve the July 28th and the August 9th minutes?
So move.
Second.
Is there discussion? No. All in favor, say aye, please.
Aye.
Aye.
And aye. Thank you. They approved unanimously. We have required approvals. Is there anything anybody would like to take out of that separately? Or if not, I'll entertain a motion for approval of the...
So move.
Thank Second. You. All right. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Okay. Unanimously approved. I'm sorry, I'm still kind of choked up. We will now go to Brandy Manuel for a quality report.
Thank you, Commissioner Bueller. And I think, there we go. All right. Tough to follow that patient's story, but I think actually the work that Tina's referencing spills right over into what I'm about to share with you. So a nice segue. Next slide, please. So as per our usual report, we're going to just do a quick flyover and look at our patient safety and quality performance in the last month. We're going to focus on our heart failure care here at Jefferson Healthcare, and then we're going to round it out with hearing some from our patients and just taking a look at some of our current priority areas and areas of focus. Next slide. So looking at this, most of the data here is from our July data. The core measure data is actually from second quarter because we are still in third quarter, so still collecting that. But overall, things are looking good. We did have one case in July of a delayed referral. So we had some issues in transitions of care, and the patient, it took him a little bit longer to get to the specialist than we would have liked. And that patient's doing well, but it certainly delayed the care and treatment that he was able to get. And so we are continuing to really focus on that through our referrals team led by Jen Wharton and a whole team of really amazing people that are already finding areas of opportunity and areas that we are adjusting as we go. And then you'll see the core measures compliance is yellow. Really, that is something that is probably experienced by most of the hospitals around us. The one area that has fallen out a little bit continues to be our ED throughput. And as volumes are surging here around our state, around our country, it's just harder and harder to get patients to their next location or their next place of care. And so what that's doing is it's really creating longer throughput times in the emergency department. So when we see yellow, generally everything else is where we would hope that it would be, with that one exception. Next slide, please. All right, so heart failure. I wanted to take just a minute and recognize, again, the work of our clinical teams. What you're looking at here is just a focus of what are considered some of the best practices in taking care of our heart failure patients. And this is the composite score. So what you see in the darker red color is Jefferson Healthcare's performance. And then what you see in the lighter sort of pink salmon color, I guess, are all of the Washington hospitals. And the line up top designates the 90th percentile performance. And the line below that represents the achievement goal, which means the level at which you achieve the designation through American Heart Association's Get With The Guidelines. And this composite represents the things in this green box related to the overall performance. So did you give the right medications? Did you provide the correct patient assessment when he or she needed it? And then did we follow up appropriately and make sure that the patient had a plan for how to manage this disease moving forward? So this represents starting this, it says Q1, but these are actually, it's by month. So this is January 1st through June 30th. Next slide, please. And I wanted to just take a minute and recognize, again, our clinical teams. We just found out this week that our team qualified for the Get With The Guidelines Heart Failure Gold Plus with Honor Roll Distinction, which is a pretty impressive feat. What that means is that that composite score, along with others, other quality indicators, have been at or above that target performance threshold for 24 months. And when we think about, as Tina mentioned, what we've been looking at over the last 24 months, and we think about just how tired the teams are, and we think about the turmoil that healthcare has been in, the fact that our healthcare teams continue to put our patients first is evident in this way. And while I'm not focusing on all of our Get With The Guidelines metrics, I will just say that they have continued to perform well in all of them. So just a huge note of gratitude and appreciation for the work that they do every day. Next slide. Oh, gosh. I wonder if my screen is frozen. Did it go forward? There we go. And so just looking at patient satisfaction across the board, our scores have leveled off, remembering that during the thick of COVID, they dipped down a little bit, often related to just the change in the way that they were getting healthcare. Remembering that our patients are some of the oldest population in the state and have some challenges sometimes with hearing, especially as it involves masks and the different level of PPE. So we're learning to communicate a little differently with our patients, but that seems to be leveling off, and overall those scores are coming back up. We are looking at kind of a different survey process for those outpatient areas where we're sending surveys. Right now, it's a really long, very comprehensive paper-based tool that gets mailed to patients' homes. And sometimes you'll see I'll put comments in here from our patients that they don't really love that process. And so we have been working with our vendor to find a better process and are looking at something that will be much more real time and will have the opportunity to send surveys out via mechanisms like text or email. So something that is not requiring books of paper to land in one's mailbox and also doesn't necessarily involve a phone call. Next slide. All right, and here are some of the current projects that we're working on. Under projects and teamwork, you can see one of our biggest projects right now is closing the loop on referrals. Jacob, our new lab director, is doing a really great job of wrapping his arms around specimen labeling and making sure that everything that we are doing around specimen labeling meets our standard and that we are consistently seeing high quality. And then again, our equity work, which we've been talking about for a while, but that is continuing to ramp up. Our data team's done an incredible job of creating reports and getting us access to information that we haven't had before. And we're working on just continuing to improve the quality of the information that's coming into our system so that we can really analyze that, identify disparities, and then work to overcome those. So that's really exciting work. Our medical staff team is also very busy at work looking at our provider mastery programs around Epic and the way we use Epic, looking at that onboarding experience. And then we're working really closely with our medical staff leaders on identifying our medical staff quality indicators and seeing how those overlap or don't with the things that they're looking at within their administrative roles. So kind of two different processes, and we're trying to align those as much as possible. And then in emergency management, a lot going on, but we will be participating in the Great Shakeout Drill in about a month. And so that will be kind of exciting. We are not sure yet if we're going to be back in person or if we're going to be doing things virtually. So we have some contingency planning we're doing around that. We also are actively planning some active shooter drills and training for our staff, both in the hospital and in the outpatient setting. And otherwise, I think most of these are things you've seen before. We are excited to have our follow-up certification in infection prevention survey from the DNV, which is scheduled on September 23rd. And we just heard that that is going to be a virtual survey. So we won't get the chance to show off our teams and our facilities like we have in the past, but we'll look forward to the virtual survey, which will just be a one-day event. And next slide. That's all that I have, unless there are questions. Commissioner Reddy?
Yeah. You mentioned the Great Shakeout Drill. When is that, and can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So traditionally, the Great Shakeout Drill happens in October. It happens across the state, and it involves people from all across schools and healthcare first responders. They all participate at different levels. And so this year will be kind of a tabletop. So we are not going to do the full activation. We're going to do it as a tabletop. Allison Crispin is doing an amazing job leading that work, and she's joined by Jennifer Peach Guzman and Colleen Rodriguez and Shannon Groff, and they are just doing an awesome job. And in fact, they've sworn me to secrecy a little bit because they don't want me to know too much, but they promised that we are going to learn a lot from the event and are hoping to just really be able to look at our processes around responding to an event like an earthquake and making sure that we know how to respond, that our leaders feel prepared to respond, and that we have good systems in place. So the date will be October 7th, and that is honestly about as much as I know, probably to protect myself. I don't know, but we'll see. So we'll be sending some information out in the next couple of weeks to our leaders to give a little bit of information about it, and that's what I know about that.
Great, thanks.
Any other questions?
So Jill, I want to follow up on Brandy's presentation and mostly speak to how cool the continued accumulation of get with the guideline recognition is. That we've sort of, to give you some context, and I think you can see this. This is a flyer that is presented every year and inserted in U.S. World Report and News that tracks all of the participants in the Get With The Guideline program throughout the entire country. And several years ago, I approached Brandy and said, hey, what's this about and where are we? And Brandy explained to me what it was about, and we went to work. Well, this is Washington's report, and you probably can't see this, but we frequently refer to this as the dots, because for every Get With The Guideline recognition, you get a dot in this report. And to give you the context of what a big deal three dots is that only one hospital in the state, first, only about a third of the hospitals in the state have any dots, have any recognition for Get With The Guidelines. Only seven hospitals have three dots, and only one has four. And after we celebrated for about 15 seconds, I said, okay, Brandy, what's the plan to get our fourth dot? And apparently it's in a category where we don't have enough volume to qualify, which I kind of thought was, you know, kind of a lame excuse, but I had to accept it. But anyway, I wanted to give you some context that three Get With The Guideline best practices for the work that we are doing is really extraordinary. And to just follow up on Brandy's astonishment about being able to do this with everything else going on the last year or so is true testament to staff and our provider leaders. So good stuff, and thank you.
That is amazing. That is good stuff. Mari, I see your hand up.
Yes, I think I heard, and I might have misheard, that somebody from the out on the coast was unable to find an ICU bed in the state and was flown to Idaho. Is that, do we know anything about that? And how difficult has it been to find places for our patients if they do need to be transported out of here?
You know, Mari, I think Dr. Mattern is gonna speak to that in his CMO comments. So if you can.
Okay, I can hold off. Thank you.
Good.
Okay. Well, thank you, Brandy and Mike, both for great information, wonderful reports, and well, jobs well done. So next we'll go for Tyler Freeman, our Chief Financial Officer. How are we doing, Tyler?
Good. How are you?
Good.
So, and overall, we are doing pretty well. Not quite as green as we were last month, but still, when we go through the numbers, you'll see overall we're in a pretty good position. So if you want to skip ahead to the next slide. So first off, FTEs, we're under budget for FTEs. We do have quite a bit of open positions right now, and that kind of, you know, you hear that getting some of the staffing stories that have been shared today. Hopefully we can get that position, the some of those positions filled, but there are some consequences of being below budget to FTEs that are a little bit nuanced that we'll get into when we get to the income statement side of things. For the inpatient side, we were down overall below budget for inpatient revenue. We were 28% above budget for ICU, 12% below for ACU, and 10% overall for below for patient days. We also had 30% less births than we budgeted. So overall, besides ICU, we were a little bit under budget in the inpatient side. Surgery cases, a little bit misleading, 5% below budget for the number of cases, but we were 13% above budget for surgery minutes. And that actually, for the general surgery department, we were 122% of our revenue budget. So, you know, one of those stats that looks red on first blush, but as you dive into the numbers, we actually did pretty well for surgeries for the month of July. Not quite the same story, but a little similar with lab, only 2% above budget for billable tests, but we ended up at 114% of revenue for the month. Total diagnostic imaging, 2% above budget. Pharmacy, 18% below for meds dispense, but again, we were at 115% of our revenue budget. So some of that is just going to be higher cost drugs that are being prescribed. And there may also be, you know, when you have such a big number of meds dispense and also a big number of for revenue, it can be a little tricky to make sure those things match up when you're doing your budget. So maybe a little bit of number issue going on with pharmacy meds as well. But overall, our pharmacy budget looked really good for the month of July. Going down to the rest of the stats, ER census, 3% above budget. We were also 21% above budget for express clinic visits for the month. So pretty significant visits there. And then rural health clinic and specialty clinics were basically at budget. I did want to follow up. Two questions that came up last time were the South County patients. And so it did a little bit more diving into that. And there was the leave issue that we spoke of last time with the provider. But then previous to that, too, they weren't at full capacity down in South County due to staffing. Overall, that the number of visits in South County that we expect are pretty small in comparison to some of our other rural health clinics. And it's just a function of the population base that's down there. And then the proximity of the Port Ludlow clinic probably also impacts the amount of people that are going to go to the South County clinic. So that is still at 33% below budget for the month of July. So pretty on pace with what we've seen so far this year out of South County. And then sleep clinic is again below budget. But as I mentioned last time, there was a ARNP that was hired July 19th. And they also hired a 0.5 PA August 13th. So there's a potential that we'll see a little bit of volume increase in sleep as those APPs get established and start seeing more visits through the clinic that then results in sleep studies. So next slide. So all of this led to a 4% above budget in gross patient service revenue. We have a little bit higher revenue adjustments for the month, and a piece of that is we do, since we are paid based on costs for Medicare, and it's always based on a previous time frame, we obviously had very high cost in 2020. So they're paying us at a much higher rate in 2021 than our costs would suggest we should be paid. So we do expect to have to pay Medicare back at the end of the year. And right now we're estimating that payback to be $3 million. So we've started to accrue some of that. And so that is contributing to a higher revenue adjustments number this month, just because we need to start building up that accrual throughout the rest of the year so that we can be prepared to pay that money back to CMS. We also had a high charity care adjustments for the month, but overall, 2% above budget for operating revenue. And then going into salaries and wages, so some of that nuance that I talked about being short on the FTE side of thing is we still are seeing a considerable amount of premium pay. It's been over 3,000 hours of premium pay per month, closer to 3,600 on average for the first 7 months of the year. And so that still bumps up the salaries even without having the FTEs in place there. We also have, because of the new RVU schedule, we have a little bit higher incentive compensation that's going out, and that was paid out for the quarter ended in July. So that is also hitting the salaries line. And then we did accrue $200,000 for the retention payments to some of the critical positions that we are currently in negotiations with the union to get those through. None of those have been paid yet. The original expectation was for them to be in September, but those are still in negotiation at this point. So all of that leads to a higher than expected salaries and wages, even with lower FTEs, but it does the low FTEs is really shown in the 23% above budget for employee benefits. And then, overall for the month, we ended up pretty much right at budget, and we're only 15% lower than our expectations for year to date. So in a pretty good spot so far, and hopefully that continues as we continue to get some of these accruals built up for these expenditures that we expect. Next slide. And this, I keep saying it, I feel like I've said this the last three commissioners meetings, we expect that green line at the top, which is our days cash on hand with the advance payment from Medicare, to start trending down and kind of narrowing into that red line, which is our overall days cash without the Medicare advance payment. But we're not seeing it yet. We have we've paid back $2.6 million to Medicare so far through withholding 25% of our Medicare payments is the way that they take that money back. And we're still in a really, really good cash position. We have the revenue cycle team has been doing really great work in trying to stay on top of it, and so far we're seeing the fruits of their labor. So hopefully that continues to persist as we continue to pay back CMS for that advance payment. And then next slide. I think there's too much to note on the board financial report, kind of what we expected. Have some more of those audit fees trickle in as the single audit was completed and some other work was done. Year to date, we'll end up pretty close to on budget. I think we budgeted about $50,000 for the full year, and we don't expect too many more audit fees to roll through that would go into the board finances. So should be good to go there, but And I don't have anything else to note on this one. So next slide. And August, as of today, we are projecting to be 103% of budget. We're averaging over $800,000 worth of charges per day, and we're also averaging $338,000 in collections per day. So charges and collections are both looking strong, and our days in AR is right about on pace with where we want it to be. Any questions?
Tyler, I have one question, curiosity question. You talked about pharmacy revenue being above budget or better than budget. Do we know what percentage of that revenue is from oncology meds?
I don't have that in front of me, but I can take that down as something to look into.
I know they're, you know, they're some of the most expensive medications that we have. So, and I know we have a lot of patients, so. Thanks.
Yeah, I'll see if I can break that out to see the percentage that's oncology next time.
Mari, do you have your hand up?
Yes, Tom, I wonder how much more is left, or what is the balance due to pay back to Medicare, please? You know, from their loan.
Yeah, one moment.
Did we borrow
it's been a while since I've looked at that. So I'll, instead of giving you an off-the-cuff guess, I'll look into that, but I can put it in through the chat.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you, Tyler. Very, very thorough report. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay.
Then we will go on then to our administrative report from our Chief Executive Officer, Mike Glenn.
Great. Thanks, Jill.
Yeah.
Alyssa, could you hit the next slide, please? I'll start with the volume report that I normally prepare for you. On the left of the screen is the COVID phone lines. And you will see that it's shaped like a U. For several weeks, we had turned that program over to public health. And then when disease started to become more prevalent in our community, we met with public health, and they were beginning to get overwhelmed, not only with phone responsibility, but also with their contact tracing. We felt the need for a higher degree of continuity with the patients who were seeking information about COVID care or information about their COVID care. So we turned that back on, and you can see that the calls shot back up to a very high level. I think the last, the 815 references, I think only counts one day. And then on the right is the drive-through testing clinic, which I don't think captures the self-swabbing program that I'll talk about in a moment, but that stays very robust. Next slide, please. The clinic volumes, primary care, right around 100% of budget. Specialty clinics really busy end of July, first couple of weeks of August, and a little slower the second week of August. Next. Cancer care running about where they have been running, right around budget, a little slower than middle of August, surgical volumes kind of bouncing around. But I think, as Tyler mentioned, we've been seeing in July, I think he may have showed a higher percent or a higher level of surgical minutes than surgical cases, indicating that we have maybe fewer, not as many colonoscopies going on, but being replaced by longer surgical procedures. Next slide. And this is a slide that I really wanted to bring your attention to. The emergency department and express clinic, that volumes are really high, really sick patients, putting stress on the entire system. You'll see that we are back up to as high as I think we've ever seen, north of 500 cases a week. I'll speak to this a little bit more later on in my presentation, but as the entire region becomes overwhelmed with patient care activity, patients from west of Port Angeles all the way to Poulsbowl in need of care will go where they think they can get it fastest. Sometimes they believe that to be true for Jefferson Healthcare. So I think the whole system right now is under a fair degree of strain as we deal with this rising number of COVID activity, a rising level of COVID activity. Next slide, please. In light of that, a couple of bullets that sort of explains where we are at. COVID cases are surging in our country and in our state and our region. A communication I shared with staff not that long ago, or a few days ago, four or five weeks ago, the state was seeing about 350, 400 positive cases a day. And now that number is over 3,000. The level of COVID activity in our community shot from about 6 to 7 a week to mid-30s, 40 positive cases a week. So there is just a greater degree of disease in our community, and we believe it's the result of the far more transmissible Delta variant. The emergency department and express clinic, the inpatient floors, and really all of our COVID services are being stretched. And Tina spoke a little bit about, and as did Tammy, about the challenges this places on everyone, but particularly the direct caregivers. We are in a situation where every morning now at 8:15 we have staffing huddles where the house supervisor and all the nurse leaders and Dr. Tracy Harris and several others just kind of go through the state of the hospital and number of patients in the emergency department, number of patients bordering in the emergency department, number of patients upstairs, number of patients in ICU, COVID positive, patients that are ready for discharge but can't be discharged for one or another reason, patients requiring one-on-one care. Just the litany of a high volume, high complexity state of patient care, and the whole organization is feeling it, but particularly those folks at the bedside. There is limited and today no bed availability in the region to transfer high acuity patients and those requiring specialty hospital treatment. It's been tight before, but the message yesterday that they're every hospital is kind of tipped over right now with respect to patient activity, available staffing, and probably running at patient to staff ratios that they are uncomfortable with. So they specifically called out the small rurals and the critical access hospitals you need to prepare for taking care of a higher level of acuity patient in your facility, because it's not as if we don't want to accept your patients, we just can't. And that's true certainly with the St. Michael's and the Virginia Masons and the Swedishes and the Harborviews, but it's also true for most of the psychiatric and chemical dependency facilities out there as well. Third, there is limited bed availability in the region and state to discharge patients in need of post-acute care or adult family home living. Some of the board members may have been CC'd on a letter from a staff member that was urging us to find a more appropriate place of care for a patient that was in need of a much higher specialty care than we were able to provide. That was probably a month ago when the letter hit, or it seems that way anyway. But I can absolutely say it was a month ago when this patient was ready to be discharged, and we finally found a more appropriate place for care for her just a couple days ago. I know you're probably getting tired of me saying this, but I've never seen a referral environment top to bottom, from adult family homes to tertiary trauma care, as tight as this one is. And you know, it's the result of this combination of surge in patient activity with a shortage state, region, and nationwide of staff for a variety of reasons, which I speak to in the next bullets. All hospitals, including Jefferson Healthcare, are experiencing staffing shortages, some related to summer PTO. We have team members who are taking well-earned, well-deserved vacation time in August. It's much more fun to vacation in the Northwest in August than it is in February, and that's great. Both COVID and non-COVID related leave of absences, that when there's an increase in disease in the community, most of our employees live in this community, and so when there is a potential exposure, we will pull that employee out of the work environment, you know, until we rule out that the exposure was just exposure and not a contact, and that's the safe and responsible thing to do. But on a daily basis, we are pulling staff out in desperately needed units of care because of that. So it's making a tight situation even tighter. And then just a rapidly changing healthcare labor market. I think there are some shifts going on now about decisions. Everybody in healthcare, but I think particularly direct healthcare givers are making, you know, about their work. And you know, I think given where we're at and what we have put and are putting healthcare employees through, it shouldn't be a surprise that there is some contemplation going on about, you know, is this what I want to do? And then lastly, elective surgical procedures are reviewed on a daily basis. We've met with all of our surgeons, and Dr. Jafari is providing great leadership with this effort, but to alert them that we are, you know, monitoring the situation very closely, and that most surgical procedures that require an overnight stay will likely be rescheduled. In certain situations, when volumes do drop, we go ahead and green light a surgery because, you know, in many cases, if you decide you want a total joint, it's a weeks long pre-op process, both to get you physically prepped for the case and just emotionally prepped for the case. And it's not a good thing to say for whatever reason we need to delay your care. I think this is a message that we need to get out to the community that the situation is pretty challenging here right now, and that it's beginning to impact. It is impacting non-COVID related care that we're able to provide, and I anticipate that we will go to the mode where we were just kind of carte blanche suspend all elective surgery cases, particularly if the next few days look like the last few days. Next slide, please. And Dr. Mattern will add some narrative to all of that from the chief medical officer's perspective. Because if it seems like I'm sounding the alarm a little bit, it's because I am. That we have heretofore been able to kind of look around us and say, Kitsap County is really being tipped over right now, or Seattle is tight. The entire region is tight now, including Jefferson Healthcare. And so we are on a higher level of alert. Earlier in the week, we sent out a memo informing all of our employees of how we intend to comply with the governor's order on vaccination mandates. This is just a copy of that memo that you should have all received too. I think some notable, but I think it's very helpful in understanding what we know about the mandate and how we are being told that it will be enforced. Some key dates included in the memo is September 6th would be the last day that you can begin a Moderna vaccination regimen and be fully vaccinated by October 18th. September 13th is the last day you can begin a Pfizer vaccination regimen and be fully vaccinated. And October 4th is the last day that you can get a J&J shot and be fully vaccinated. And that, you know, it's August 25th. So it's if your preference is an mRNA vaccination or a fully FDA approved vaccination, we are gearing up to accommodate patients and employees in the next couple of weeks. Next slide, please. This is just a copy of the exemption request forms. This one is for the religious exemption. And what I will bring to your attention is the sincerely held the line where, or the opportunity for employees to demonstrate how the exemption or the religious conviction has been sincerely held. And the state has provided definitions to help organizations with that, and some interpretive guidelines to help with this analysis. But it's a case by case basis, and we are putting together a process to complete that, in a fair and reasonable way, trying to stay within the lane of guidelines offered by the state. Next slide. The medical exemption is a little different. The form must be signed by a physician, a physician's assistant, or a nurse practitioner. So there is an extra step involved. And we are putting together a multidisciplinary committee to help us review these. So just launched. I think we hit send on this two nights ago. We're having a department director's webinar meeting tomorrow to go over questions and address concerns. If you imagine that, you know, this is creating distress in some of our employees, you are correct. And it's an unfortunate thing. But, you know, as we have shared with our employee base, it's the law of the land, we're now focused on complying with it. Next slide. So vaccinations, there is a lot going on in the vaccination world. In addition to the FDA approval of the Pfizer shot, you may have heard in the last week or so the interest around booster shots. And I was going to share a little bit more information in this slide, and Dr. Mattern suggested I don't, because there's still much that has to be determined. And I'm glad I didn't, because just in the last three or four days of when I put these slides together, the dates and what we thought we knew about when this would begin and for whom have changed. But what we do know is third doses for immunocompromised patients has begun. And Tina and the vaccination team have done a great job of planning to work that third shot right into the care and treatment of our oncology patients upstairs. So it won't require a one-off if we are seeing them and can just jab them as part of their cancer treatment. And then we're working with Public Health and Department of Emergency Management to likely provide some kind of mini mass vaccination clinics, perhaps in our Dirksen auditorium, and they are scouting out some other sites to be able to treat this vulnerable population. It does appear that most of the breakthrough cases that we are seeing, and particularly the breakthrough cases that result in hospitalization, and or death, are in this population. So I believe the data is beginning to show this immunocompromised needs maybe a little bit more vaccine than a younger and healthier person. And then right around the corner is booster doses for eligible patients. What we initially heard was that this could start as soon as September 20th. So we began working backwards or reverse engineering a plan to make sure that the vaccine was available for healthcare employees, right? Because we were first in the first wave of vaccinations, and some of our employees are, December 16th was when this all started, so if you play out this, so when fully vaccinated was end of January, well, we're now approaching the end of August, a booster shot regimen that focuses on that first wave, which happens to be mostly healthcare employees, will be very well received here. And the only question is when it will begin. There was some thought that it was 8 months after the second shot, but now the discussion has begun, and people in white coats as opposed to people in white shirts are are going to make the recommendation, which is good. And we expect to learn when that will be and for whom in the next couple of weeks. But we are working closely with Willie at DEM and Public Health. And once again, they're being great partners. And we will make sure that there's vaccine available. One complicating factor in this is that there still is a strong recommendation that the booster shot be consistent with the first two. And, you know, we've nearly always ran our vaccination clinics. You know, it's a Moderna day or a Pfizer day or a Moderna afternoon and maybe a J&J morning. And that for lots of reasons, but mostly just efficiency and making sure that we provide the right dose to the right drug to the right patient. This might be a little more challenging to manage because you might have people who had wishing to get their booster that had all three vaccinations or vaccines. And right now we can get and have certainly the J&J and Pfizer on board. I think we can get Moderna, but it's, you know, these things always seem so easy when it's announced from the highest lectern that this is what's going to happen. But they are, as Jen Wharton will tell you, far more complicated to actually roll out and do well. Next slide, please. I wanted to touch briefly on some of these services that we have stood up and you know, really in the last 4 weeks. We went from, you know, talking at SLG about deconstructing our COVID-related services to rapidly standing them up again and making them more robust. Spoke about the nurse consult line and the role that is playing. When the final story is told about our response to COVID, I think one of the other really cool tales will be how we've created a barrier-free approach to testing, where many patients, particularly 3 weeks ago or so, were concerned about an exposure or a contact, or you know, they had a scratchy throat or sniffles, and when there's high prevalence in your community, it's not unreasonable to leap to, holy smokes, I think I might be COVID positive. I need to do the responsible thing and be tested. And we were working through this sort of call the nurse consult line, the nurse would talk you through and then determine if you know you were symptomatic or if the exposure resulted in the need for a likely test. That system quickly got overwhelmed when the demand for testing increased. So patients were just showing up at the express clinic for the sole purpose of getting a test. And that was not what we had set up the express clinic for. It kind of breached our interest in isolating potential COVID patients. It was creating flow issues for them. We developed a system to where we actually prepackage self-swabbing kits, keep them outside of the emergency department, and have signage that if patients are just interested in a test, that they pick up one kit and follow the instructions, and then come by and drop the kit off either at the drive-through testing station, or now we have a drop box. And to show you how successful this has been, we went the last 4 weeks are we did about 419 tests 1 week, 432 tests the following week, 473 tests the following week when we just introduced this. And the first full week of this program, we did 774 tests. Interestingly, the percent positive which is something we've been following, was hovering between 7 and 8% when we were doing about 4% or 400 tests a week. It dropped down to 3.5% this last week. So what I think happened is that a lot of worried well, maybe less symptomatic, or people that if they had gone through the consult line probably said, you know what, let's continue to watch. I don't think you require a test, but you know, thanks for calling. So it's a high demand. It's another burden on, you know, a system that already is teetering. Those are tests that our laboratory is processing, and we are dealing with sharing the results. But from a public health perspective, it's good surveillance to, you know, test that many people in 1 week in a community our size. You really get a good idea of what's happening. It's a great program. We're struggling a little bit with the ratio of kits taken versus kits coming back, and we're trying to find the right words to implore upon our community to there's scarcity of these packs and only take what you need, because we will run out, and that would be a bad thing. At the same time, not discouraging people from testing when they need to test. So next is the res clinic. We had shut the res clinic down, and then 2 weeks ago decided we needed to plan to stand that back up. When we are spread so thin, it's not a matter of pulling two resources or three resources off the bench and standing up this new system. It's moving them from an already under-resourced area of the hospital or the clinics. So we have been proceeding with caution and looking for some innovative solutions. Dr. Harris had a great discussion with her hospitalist colleagues, and they said, tell us how we can help. Which is just captures, I think, the spirit of the entire team throughout the last, you know, 18 months. But we do intend to stand that up not only as a place to direct patients that we feel, are symptomatic and need to be isolated from, bumps and scrapes and lacerations that you see in the Express Clinic, but also. There is a treatment, monoclonal antibody treatment, which once someone does test positive relatively early in their exposure, it's a treatment that is effective at moderating the acuity of the illness to where it's effective in keeping patients out of the hospital. It's an infusion-like procedure, and the patient needs to be watched. Hospitals are overrun right now. So the thought is maybe we can do some of that in the ARIA and the res clinic. So great team trying to get to yes on all of that work. And then lastly, we've added additional providers, both in the emergency department and Express Clinic. For instance, today, Dr. Johns helped out in the Express Clinic at a time when they were getting slammed because, you know, in addition to all of this other activity, we're seeing this uptick. Jefferson Healthcare is, I don't know about Jefferson County, but an uptick in walk-in need for vaccinations. Well, that's a good thing, but when there's so much other stuff going on, it just makes a tough care environment even more difficult. We frequently will have two providers in Express Clinic working through patients, and the emergency department has been approved to add another provider during the day. To help with their growing volumes, and Dr. Smith is working on on finding a kind of a staffing matrix to allow it to happen. So we're holding it together, you know, kind of on a day by day basis, and mostly because of you know, people stepping up and carrying a heavier load than they should be carrying right now. And then, so I take a break, take a quick breath after that heavy note, go ahead, Alyssa. So everyone loves John, and John was pretty clear about how he would like to ease on into his retirement, and very clear about not making a fuss about it. And under normal circumstances, I'd probably say okay, but John has left an extraordinary footprint on Jefferson Healthcare, done everything from, you know, run OB to run IT to drive the heart van around, and I think every job, probably including mine at some point while he was here. And in addition to that, just a real swell guy that we're gonna miss the hell out of. So I'm sorry, John, but it was important to me and many of your friends here that your departure does not go completely unnoticed. So I hope this wasn't too painful for you. All right, that concludes my comments.
Hey, thank you, Mike, and thank you for that tribute to John, too. Well deserved. Murray, I saw your hand up. Is that you have a question?
Yes, a couple of questions. So, Mike, given the shortage of staff, I wonder if is there any way, any thought of Wisher or us asking to extend the Governor Inslee October 14th deadline, because in some ways, what is worse than if some staff can't make the deadline or for one reason or another don't get vaccinated, that we'll be even shorter of staff, which certainly doesn't benefit our patients. So that's question one. And the other one is the costs. I assume these test kits are costly, or at least cost some money. Is that an expense that we have to pay ourselves, or do we get reimbursed, or what is the cost?
Well, the answer to your first question is I can pass that on to Wisha. I don't think there would be any appetite from the governor's office for that, but I'll pass the sentiment on, Mari.
Thank you.
It's probably less about the cost of the kits. And there's the supplies themselves, you know, the swab with some median and maybe a few other little things, and an instruction sheet. Hey, someone has to put them together. But it's just the availability. There have been times where throughout the last 18 months, every as Kelly O'Connell will attest, every supply item we ever order has been in shortage. You know, it's just whenever pick the week, pick the month, and oh my gosh, we can't get our hands on this, including swabs. It wasn't that long ago when finding swabs to do this work was next to impossible. So I think the bigger concern is just making sure that supply line stays intact, because, you know, we don't mind handing out 600 kits and doing 600 tests or even 500 tests. It's when that ratio drops below 50% that you just want to encourage your community to be responsible with a scarce resource. And we're working on some different ways in which we can do that.
And I would, if I may, like to say, John Nowak. I met John about 40 years ago when I applied for a job here, and he's been a colleague, a friend, and a great supporter over the years. And I cannot reinforce the sentiments about the sterling job that John has done over the years. I say, OB, ICU, emergency room. He worked in OR. He ran the heart car. He implemented help in Epic. All those things that John has done. What a great guy, and he will be sorely missed on a professional and a personal basis. So, way to go, John. Enjoy your retirement.
Hey, thank you. I have a couple of a two-part question. Do we have enough first and second doses of vaccine for our employees who will have to be vaccinated? Okay. And the second, if an employee is exempted, is there a different protocol for that employee?
I think this is a great time to segue into the CMO report. So.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mike, for your very sobering but important.
You're welcome.
And Joe, I imagine you have some equally sobering information.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I must be
chief medical officer.
Yeah. Thanks. I must be rubbing off on Mike because I think he just gave my report for me. You know, that was a pretty good CEO CMO report. It was kind of interesting as. I went through my notes. I was like, "Oh, Mike's kind of going through things." So I will add some comments and a little kind of color commentary to some of the stuff that Mike brought up. And but mostly, I think probably open it up for y'all to provide some questions because there's a lot here to digest and process. And I, you know, I'll start first. But Tamara, your first point about, you know, do you delay and the timing, and you wouldn't be the first among the staff to kind of say, you know, why now on the vaccine mandate, and, you know, are we going to lose folks? What I will tell you that there is not an insignificant population of amongst the workforce here and, you know, in healthcare in general that's saying, why do we wait so long? Why do we wait this so long to kind of just get to the point where we say, you know what? It took a global pandemic for us to kind of just say that you probably shouldn't be in healthcare if you don't believe in vaccines. Now, if you have a medical barrier or your faith is a barrier, we recognize that we won't have 100% and that there is a channel and there is a role for those people to participate in healthcare. But philosophically, if you're not going to take that step to protect yourself, to protect your colleagues, and to most of all protect your patients, that It's time. And so if this is the moment that we say, you know, we've kind of let this go for a while and now we have to recognize kind of moving forward. So you draw the line someplace. And I think there are people who recognize saying, you know what, we'll be short in some places if people leave, but that's probably not the person who is best for my department or is best as my teammate. So just a different perspective. It was going to be something that came up sooner or later, but I think there's a significant portion of our patients who I think were a little bit shocked to learn that that wasn't the case already, that the numbers wouldn't be higher, as my neighbor said to me while we were out working in the yard. He was kind of scratching his head saying, like, I'm trying to wrap my head around about how you could be in healthcare and not be doing that. So again, there is a lane for the medical and if your religious faith is a barrier, but it's a pretty narrow lane. So just along with what Mike was saying, Mike asked a question to some team members the other day of, you know, is the roller coaster at the top of the track and are we starting to come down? And the answer's no to that, as far as new cases, and certainly not with regard to hospitalizations across the region. I have some reasons to believe that our roller coaster peak will come earlier than the rest of the state, partly because of vaccinations, but also because, again, throughout the pandemic, we have a community that takes it seriously. that takes masking seriously. And so when the health officer says, you know, it's time to mask again, and when the providers and, you know, doctors and other health, you know, public health figures say we need to change how we're doing things, people start to listen, and they start to take that seriously in the community. So I think we'll start to see some changes, but the impact of what is happening right now is going to be felt by our community in other ways for a while. And part of what Mike was talking about with hospital bed capacity. So there's our own staffing that will continue to be a challenge. Partly with the higher cases, you know, we are having healthcare workers vaccinated who have exposures because of what's happening in their home life, as sort of someone else gets sick. And we'll see what happens with school opening. Again, I think we've got school districts that take this seriously and will be very good about masking and making sure that they follow the right protocols to keep kids safe. But we know that with the Delta variant, when the virus comes into your household, even if you're vaccinated, you have a higher risk of breakthrough. It's a greater virus that is produced by the greater numbers of virus particles that are produced by the Delta variant. And that's how it overcomes some of these barriers that we had. So we get back to this idea of layers of safety. But the biggest cases of breakthrough occur when you have exposure to someone without the protection. So without a mask in your home life, or if you have a breakdown of your protective equipment in a high risk medical situation. You know, when we see cases of outbreaks in healthcare facilities, we're still seeing it more likely in the break room or what's happening outside socializing without, you know, kind of together. That's when we're seeing it across the region more so than the outbreak in the ICU room or in the emergency department. So we are still getting more attentive and getting folks back in that mindset again of erring on the side of, you know, extra PPE if you don't know a person's status, and not assuming because they're vaccinated that they can't have the infection. And so just trying to get everyone's guard back up again has been part of the work. But it means for us from a staffing standpoint on our own that, you know, as Mike was alluding to, we have this issue of, you know, what's going on in the community. And if we have an employee who's vaccinated and exposed now, they're not necessarily going to be able to come into work in the way that earlier on in the pandemic we said, oh, if you're vaccinated and you have an exposure, you're not necessarily you're going to quarantine because we don't think you're going to get it. We don't think you're going to spread. So we're taking extra precautions. Our hospitalization rates of COVID patients is still fairly low. These patients tend to stay in the hospital longer, though, so it's not uncommon for when we do have a hospitalized patient to be in, you know, 7+ days. And so we've been having 1 to 3 COVID patients in our hospital at any one time. So that generally wouldn't, you know, seem like much for us, actually. You know, in the past, we've been able to, you know, have bed capacity up to, you know, 21, 22 patients that we can staff. But there's some important things to kind of keep in mind about what else is going on with bed capacity, which is this whole idea that because hospital capacity is going away throughout the state, there's not only the, you know, the hospital bed or acute care beds, but also mental health beds are harder to come by, and discharges to skilled nursing facilities and rehab centers. And so the result is we're hanging on to sicker patients sometimes who have to stay for longer stays. We're staying on to patients who sometimes can't discharge to a nursing home or to an assisted living facility. And those kinds of patients can be more intensive. So the overall number might seem lower when you're seeing average census. You might be thinking, well, gosh, you know, 13 beds. So we can staff that with a smaller number. But keep in mind, when we hold on to patients who are demented or and can get agitated at night and try to wander around the hospital, where we get patients who have mental health issues who are at risk to harm themselves. That requires one-to-one monitoring sometimes. And when we have COVID patients who have special quarantine and isolation requirements, the amount of staffing energy that goes into them is different than a typical patient, as far as who goes in the room and how we manage those patients. So the number may seem low on a quantity, but I assure you the quality and intensity of the patients is certainly challenging our staff right now. And this is, like Mike said, I mean, unlike anything else we've seen. So what we've now had before in the first wave of hospitalizations from COVID, you know, early on in the first couple waves, you didn't have the same amount of other stuff. And people stayed home from the hospital. People stayed home from their specialists and their primary care. We're seeing and we're catching up with all that care. And some of what you're seeing in the hospital is the result of some delayed care and things that were kind of put off for a while. And so that bill is coming due at the same time as the COVID cases are coming up. And keep in mind, what is taking up the hospital beds across the region again is primarily not breakthrough infections. This is unvaccinated people who are hospital beds. So while we're seeing breakthrough infections go up for vaccinated people, which is what we kind of expect to see when you have large numbers, what you're seeing is that the hospitalizations are being driven primarily by unvaccinated individuals. And so there's still, when we look at kind of vaccination rates across Washington, there's still a large percentage of our population that is vulnerable to infection and therefore vulnerable to hospitalization. So when we see these cases and these numbers rising, still remember the hospitalization peak is going to continue to go on. And these are long hospitalizations that hold up hospital beds, then need, in some cases, when they survive their infection, need discharge to facilities. So the lingering effect of this wave of infections is going to be felt for weeks and months to come. So even when we're not having COVID patients, the other care that we do is going to be impacted. So it's just important for folks to kind of understand, you know, that ripple effect. And again, until we get, it's good to see, we're starting to see a bump in an interest in vaccinations again. So people who, whether it's the mandate or whether it was the full approval of the Pfizer vaccine by the FDA, we're seeing people, you know, have renewed interest. That's going to take a while to have the impact that we need to see. And we need to see bigger numbers than we're seeing right now. We're not seeing a surge of vaccinations like we're seeing a surge of hospitalizations. But that is the way out of this from a standpoint of, medical capacity. And we're back to the same conversation we had in the beginning, right? Flatten the curve so that way we don't become overwhelmed. And here we are again, except for the fact that this time we actually have the tool. And just to give an idea of how important the vaccine is for preventing hospitalization, a study published by the CDC yesterday in the Morbidity Mortality Weekly Report, looking at Los Angeles and the difference vaccinated versus unvaccinated. And it's almost a 30-fold difference in risk for hospitalization. So when people are like, well, if you can get breakthrough infections, why get vaccinated anyway? Well, the reason is that, which is that, the person who is unvaccinated gets COVID is almost 30 times more likely to end up in the hospital than the person who's not. And the person who needs the most protection with their vaccine still are the people with immune compromising conditions, people who have weakened immune systems, because those are the people who make up a significant portion of the breakthrough infections that do end up in the hospital. So our experience is similar around here, which is that we're seeing, you know, breakthrough cases with vaccination. Typically, it's mild illness. We have had a patient who's been hospitalized who also has an underlying condition. So when we see that breakthrough again in the hospital, it's typically there's another story to it. But by far, the majority of the people who we see in the hospital are the people who are unvaccinated. So, you know, the plan here is, you know, Mike was kind of talking about how we've, you know, we deconstructed things and now we've ramped things back up. So just a couple comments about some of the stuff that he went over. Testing has to be low barrier right now because the health department is, they are also feeling these increase in numbers, and they had a testing plan that involved antigen testing, and supplies of that testing have been hard to come by. So they're struggling. So we needed to fill that void again. We also needed to fill it in a way that wasn't going to overrun our staff. So this low barrier, you know, self-swab model, it may cost us some, you know, swabs that don't come back. The flip side is that we're beginning to get some more control again over the results and making sure that, you know, one, that people can get tested, that there's not a significant barrier to getting tested. We may be, you know, in some cases people would say over-testing, but I think at this point in the pandemic, that's a good thing. We know that, you know, when we get a positive, we know that is getting reported to the health department so they can do the, you know, what contact tracing they can at this point with their staff. We also can better understand exposures or reduce future exposures to our staff. If we know someone's comes back with a positive test and we see that they have an appointment in, you know, primary care or a specialty clinic or a procedure, we know that we can cancel it. We can start to plan. We can prepare. So it's good that we're doing this. The overall cost of the kits is probably not that significant. It's just about the supply chain and making sure that we don't run out. In fact, now we can actually, before there was a significant cost to us about sending more of the tests out to University of Washington or Northwest Pathology, we're able to do a significant majority of the tests in-house. So we can, we're not having extra costs for doing these tests. So the reimbursement can cover some of the work that we're doing. So the trick then becomes, how do we continually refine the process so it's not so burdensome on the staff? And so that's the work right now. So whether it's, you know, drop boxes and you know, changing a little bit about the triage model and how we notify people with results. So we're doing some work that way to minimize the staff burden to this, but to keep the barrier to testing low. The visit model. So Mike mentioned the respiratory clinic. And it's interesting, the conversation today has changed a little bit because one of the things that we're realizing, it's a little different at this point in the pandemic. So the need for visits for all these patients is there's some people who absolutely need to be triaged and sent to the emergency department. But what we're finding is that more and more of these people need testing up front first, and then some better triage about what kinds of visits that they need. So because we can still get good testing turnaround, what we're probably less focused about doing is needing to evaluate as many people in a respiratory or express clinic, but get them tested and then find spaces for them with their primary care provider, possibly with tele-visits, as well as find some capacity with an express clinic. What we do need, so the transition or maybe the evolution of the respiratory clinic, is more to move into what Mike already had mentioned about monoclonal antibody treatment. This is something that has been hard to operationalize for many medical centers and clinics across the country because it's an infusion of a medication that can reduce hospitalization for patients if given early on in the infection. But it requires an evaluation. It requires bringing an infected person into your medical center where they then, you know, require a IV or subcutaneous infusion that then requires an hour of observation. So there's staff exposure, there's coordination. It's also under an emergency use authorization. So there's a consenting and making sure the patient understands the true benefits of the risk. So what we're focusing on as of late this afternoon is less about the respiratory clinic as a evaluation for someone who's got a scratchy throat, because we think we have some ways between testing and our existing processes to incorporate that. And what we're more interested is about fully developing the, I have a positive result and I have a patient who would qualify. How do we get them referred in, and how do we staff? And this is where the hospitalists are willing to help supply, because the outcome of decreasing hospitalizations, as we just said, is kind of a big deal right now in Washington. So if we can decrease and we can reduce the chance that one or two patients need to be hospitalized with their COVID infection, then we are improving the sustainability of our current system. So that's a focus right now. And then vaccinations, Mike talked about how particularly the difference between the booster shot and immune compromise. So people who have immune compromise condition, we're in the process of getting them their third dose, which can be anytime 28 days after their second dose. And this is specifically a case where we think that people aren't going to respond initially to a two-dose series. And so people with organ transplant, people with active cancer, people who are on immune suppressing medication. So through the oncology clinic and through our work with the Department of Emergency Management, we've got a plan to provide some clinics. We're fitting people in as well in our vaccine clinic out of primary care. So we have a process for that. What's coming with the booster is that, and we don't have the details yet. So there's a press report now. So before, the Biden administration said, well, it's going to be 8 months. That's a political, I think this is when it's going to be authorized. The science will tell you that the immunity seems to be waning a bit sooner than that. So the report today, the rumor is that it may be more like 6 months after your second dose that you may be eligible. And it may be certain populations. It may be people over the age of 60, people over the age of 65. It may be just healthcare workers. So we're going to see what the final recommendation will be. But we've already started to prepare with the Department of Emergency Management, because to get a lot of people their boosters in a short period of time, we're going to need more of the drive-up model. And they're doing some great planning, and we're having great conversations about making sure that we have vaccine supplies and coordination. But we'll probably know more. The ACIP, which is the group that oftentimes makes the recommendation for the extra doses or the frequency or the timing, they will be meeting again at the end of the month, I believe August 30th, 31st. So I'm anticipating first week of September will likely be when we get the actual recommendations, and then we'll kind of begin the planning. So that's to come. We'll see what those recommendations show. We'll see if they recommend a booster with the same vaccine that you got before. There is some data out there about mixing and matching and some other things that could potentially help immunity. So they may also throw us a little bit of a curveball. So we don't want to do too much planning because we're not quite sure what the final clinical recommendation is. And then the last thing I'll bring up before taking your questions, which is back to the basics of prevention. So, until we have boosters, this is your booster. It's your mask. That is your booster. Masks still, they never stopped working. We just stopped using them because we didn't think that we needed to as much on the current data. And what we know now is that we need them again. We need this intervention. And so it's important for our staff to be, thinking about what they're doing with their time outside of the hospital to stay safe. It's important that our community is thinking about what they're doing with their time to stay safe, staying out of indoor spaces and crowded areas, and contact with people without a mask, particularly in indoor spaces, is really important right now. And, what we've been doing is emphasizing again, around the house of the importance of keeping your meetings, doing more online when you can, or more video meetings, making sure that you're masked when you're in person for your meetings. Taking the time to have an outdoor walk-in meeting is also a good choice. Just getting back to the basics that got us through the first part of this pandemic again, and just reinforcing. So that's what we have to do here. And it's actually what we have to rely on our community now to do. So I'll be quiet. That's my color commentary to what was Mike's very good CMO report, by the way. I give him credit for doing the slides that I never like to do. So.
Well, combined, both of those reports were very, very comprehensive, and we really have a great idea of what's going on in our area. Thank you. Bruce, you have a question? I see your hand up.
Yeah, Joe, you've talked about masks, and you've talked about bending the curve that we talked about a lot early on. So some states have gone to mandating masks outdoors as well as indoors. And, you know, you think about the White River thing, and then, you know, you go, if you happen to drive downtown on Thursday nights with concerts at the dock, there's a lot of people close together with no masks. Do you think the state or the county will move in that direction?
Not necessarily. You know, it's interesting. There's really not great, there's not great data showing that outdoor events are these, you know, big opportunities for transmission. And I had a conversation with our health officer, Dr. Barry, and, you know, she made the point that outdoor masks, you know, how much of a benefit is there? Now, I think if you're if I was, you know, at the concerts at the dock and dancing around in a very tight circle and I didn't know the vaccination status of folks, I'm not sure that's the activity I'd want to be doing right now. But I don't think people playing sports, people, you know, kind of out, kind of walking on the street and, you know, kind of about in the community, doing their activities. These are low risk, particularly where there's kind of brief passing. And there's some benefit to not doing it from a human behavioral standpoint. And this is purely CMO editorial comment, which is, when you ask a lot of folks, ask of the things that are most important. And I think, you know, to me, when you get back to the, you know, if we're sort of asking to people to wipe down things when it really isn't an important time to wipe, you know, important to wipe down to prevent things, you know, so wiping down your groceries again, or, you know, wearing masks everywhere you go outside so that you don't want to take a walk, you get down, you get depressed, you get frustrated. And what I'd rather have people do is select the activities and be like, you know what, if it's the difference of like I can be unmasked outdoors because that's a low risk, and I will choose that activity as opposed to going in or versus out. Because I think, you know, human behavior is like, well, if it's, you know, I have to do all this stuff, well, then, you know, forget about it. Like, you know, they just kind of get overwhelmed and they get or they, you know, don't want to do any of it. So I'd rather kind of pick the high risk situations to see folks kind of focus and engage on, because it really is, you know, the dispersion of respiratory particles outside is extremely fast. And what we're really talking about is being in a closed space where respiratory particles can build up, or you're kind of in really kind of closer contact with folks. So I think, you know, looking at the situation of, you know, if you're going to the Seahawks or the Sounders game, you know, what do you do outside? And I think you kind of look at the situation and you see, but there was a good study of cases after the Lollapalooza concert, which I think was maybe it was Chicago this year. And that event was, you either had to be vaccinated or you had to show proof of a negative test within 72 hours. And the number of cases, the case rate after the concert was extremely low. And there was probably a mosh pit with the occasional, you know, positive breakthrough case that sort of had, you know, found its way in there. So I think that the outdoor events is not where we need our energy, where I think it really, where I really worry about, we have Wooden Boat Festival coming up, and I've talked about it with, you know, Mike and some other folks. I'm less concerned about the people wandering around outside for the wooden boat. I'm more concerned if, you know, the weather turns and they all want to pack into one of the local pubs to have a drink and they want to get out of the weather. That's the situation that is a setup for a spread. You know, people, you know, bars, restaurants seem to have, you know, limiting hours and, you know, having more outdoor seating seem to make a difference, on this pandemic. Masks make a difference on this pandemic. You know, particularly masking in key places, schools, for example, and other kind of indoor spaces, you know, workplaces. So vaccinations make a difference. These are the layers of protection that you're looking for. But so that was kind of a long-winded answer, but I hope it helps a bit.
Thank you. Yes, Maury.
Well, sort of a comment. And Joe, you know, 70,000 people are watching Tottenham Hotspur last weekend. singing at the top of their lungs. So would it be interesting if the United Kingdom, I'm sure they will be looking at the results, you know, the respiratory results, if you like, of that. And it would be a good thing to, I would say, follow, but at least keep an eye on, because it amazes me when you get all those people, 70,000, singing and yelling at the top of their voices, and see what the increase in COVID is over there, because I don't believe they all have to be vaccinated to get into those games.
No, you have to. It's interesting. So for Lumen Field, for the Sounders, originally you had to be vaccinated to be in the lower bowl in the full capacity sections. Now they've dropped that, but if you are not fully vaccinated, you're supposed to wear your mask. I'm not quite sure how they're going to enforce that actually at the games. It's difficult in the early part of the pandemic. The Champions League game in I think Italy was or Spain were some of the first super spreader events. It's so hard to differentiate, though. What was it, the stadium, or was it all the time spent in the pubs and the restaurants before and after the game, and packed into the, you know, to the public transportation to and from the game? What were the things? So when we have these events, I think what's important to understand that they're a package deal, and it can be a little bit hard to separate, but you can certainly know what we know at this point in the pandemic. We certainly know certain situations for sure are high risk. And we know that people have let their guard down a little bit. And we know that people who are vaccinated are tired of they're tired of wearing masks too. And they're tired of that they're being asked to do things again when they feel like they're protecting people who have chose not to have the vaccine. But try to remind people that kids under the age of 12 don't have a choice. And there are some people who have medical conditions who, you know, they made the choice, but the vaccine's not working as well for them. So we still have a duty and responsibility, and we can't just be casual. But I think, you know, what our community needs to do is, if we're going to have a wooden boat festival, we have to take seriously that, you know, and think about, what are we doing with restaurant capacity? How are we controlling populations? What are we doing with regard to vaccination or test result status? And how, you know, are we holding up to that? So if you're committed to doing those things, there's a path probably to do it, a bit more safely, but it needs to be thoughtful.
And I think also recognize that typically in the summer, when there's a large crowd event that occurs, there's a spike of emergency department activity that comes with 20 to 30,000 people coming into town. And normally in the summer, we have that capacity. We don't have that capacity right now. So that's a different issue, but an equally concerning one.
Yeah, I'm less concerned about, you know, a lot of these people will come, and the question is, they're going to head back to their home after a weekend, and the question will be, what do they take back with them? For the most part, there will be some people, though, who may not end up in our, you know, hospital or ED, but they may end up using some of our testing, because we have seen some of our positive cases in the last week have been people who were traveling through the region and found out there was a place to test and made use. So we've had people from East Coast and West Coast who are not permanent residents, who are part of our positive results in the last week or so. And so I would not be surprised to see some of that. I don't know if that would translate necessarily to folks who are getting sick while they're here and kind of utilizing your resources. But there certainly is anytime you bring a lot of people together from a lot of different places and mingling, it's a higher risk situation.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Thank you, Dr. Manner. Oh, Murray.
Well, just to Mike, I guess if some of our COVID patients are in 7 or more days, the 96-hour rule has gone bye-bye.
That's gone.
Yeah.
It's under the emergency proclamation right now. So, yeah.
Good, because I have a personal interest in it. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Mattern and Mike. And we'll move on then to the board reports. And I promised Case, before I saw how long it was, I promised Case that I would read his report. And a debt, a promise made is a debt unpaid. So I will read the report quickly. And this is for the Board of Health. Last Thursday, and Case says, I'm sorry that I will miss the meeting this week. I will be out in the mountains with my extended family, a last chance before school. Hey, personnel, the Board of Health meeting last week was the first one with the new health officer, Dr. Allison Berry, who is doing an excellent job and taking over in spite of the dramatic increase in COVID-19 cases in both Clallam and Jefferson counties. It was the last meeting with Vicki Kirkpatrick, who has done an excellent job as the Director of Public Health during this stressful pandemic. We are fortunate to have Apple Martine hired from inside the agencies as the new director. New legislation creates several comprehensive health districts supporting the work of local health departments. Many of us hope that these districts will help prevent the problem that some health officers experienced in Eastern Washington when they tried to enforce scientifically based pandemic precautions. Jefferson Healthcare was active in supporting local control and in maintaining our own local health officer. We succeeded in that regard. However, the law does require us to change the composition of local boards of health in a different way. Local boards may not have more than 50% elected officials. Our current board of 7 members has 4, 3 county commissioners and a representative from the city, and 3 others. The representative from our public hospital district, my position, is not being considered as an elected official, but rather as someone representing public health, healthcare facilities, and providers. 2 of our other board members cover other categories, but we need to add 1 more member, and to meet the variety of criteria for selection, she or he must be from a local tribe. We look forward to this expansion, though the number of members will be 8, which could result in a tied vote. We have decided for now to live with this remote problem. 3, COVID-19 pandemic. We spend more time on the COVID pandemic, but I will not try to summarize any of that information. It is available in the recording, and Dr. Mattern can give a much better update than can I. 4, opiate epidemic deaths. There is a dreadful increase in fentanyl-caused deaths across the country, the state, and the Olympic Peninsula. 5, CHIP. We had a conversation about the future of CHIP and how John Nowak was so instrumental in co-leading this important effort. We acknowledge that it rightfully belongs primarily in the health department realm, but I stress the importance of the work that the public hospital district was doing in our population health efforts. I'm sorry to miss the presentation and discussion about CHIP at the board meeting this week, yet hope to contribute something to that discussion in the near future. I do believe that a certain amount of involvement with CHIP by Jefferson Healthcare is appropriate, and I am willing to help with that however I can. And that's the end of the report. I think you all have copies of that. And then the second item that we have on the agenda under board reports is an amendment to Mike's employment agreement. There's a clause in his contract that differs from other senior district managers' contracts in restricting how he can use his paid time off. The restriction is unworkable, and as a result, each year we have voted to allow Mr. Glenn more leeway in how to use his paid time off. Therefore, it makes sense to modify his contract once and for all, because we've been doing it every year, to allow Mr. Glenn to use, carry over, and dispose of paid time off on substantially the same terms as other district senior management. So he's going to be in line. Mike's contract will be in line with the rest of the SLG. It makes sense. We've been doing it. We have a resolution before you to consider. If you're comfortable and you've read the resolution and you're comfortable with doing it at this meeting, then I would entertain a motion to pass that resolution. If not, then we can act on it in the next meeting. Is there a motion to approve?
So resolution? Move.
Is there a second? Okay. Is there discussion? All right, then I call for the vote. All those in favor of approving the resolution to amend our Superintendent Mike Glenn's employment contract, say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? And Matt, did you vote aye? Are you abstaining?
Did.
You did. Okay. Great. I was trying to see everybody, but I couldn't. All right. It's unanimous. And we have approved that resolution.
Thank you for Thank that.
Thank you. That is resolution number. Pardon me? Okay. That's Thank resolution you. Number 2021-02. Okay, is there other board business or reports? Okay, then we can go on to our meeting evaluation. Ari, your top right there.
Well, there was an extraordinary amount of information, particularly all the way through, and very interesting, the presentation from Nell and the pharmaceutical, the retirement of John Nowak, Tina Toner's excellent and heartwarming and really heartfelt comments about staff and nursing, and she's just a great asset to our hospital. And then the rest of the information, I mean, it's just it sort of one of the fullest and more meaningful board meetings. It's just, I think it was a great meeting.
Thank you. Matt?
Yeah, very packed meeting, and yeah, I just want to say thank you to all of our staff for, everything they're doing and how hard they're working. I hope we get some relief soon in all of the in all of this. So, that's all.
Bruce?
Yeah, I really don't have anything different. I mean, it's always good reports, lots of good information, and Mike had some sobering information as well, you know, with where we're at on things, but we kind of know that. Yeah, Tina's, report was really good, and I mean, the nurses and the staff, I mean, they just continue to do amazing things. I mean, they really are the angels among us.
Absolutely. I agree with everything all of you said, and I just, it's a staggering position we're in right now. You just look at everything in the world that's going on, and it's here in this microcosm, we're having the same sorts of things. And I just can't say enough about our staff and how they have stepped up to the plate, and all the cliches that you want to say that are wonderful and good and great, please just, I can't add to them. Thank you. And Mike, would you like to chime in? And is there anything you have to say about our meeting? What did you think?
Nope. Lots of stuff. We tried to strike, an appropriate chord or tone with respect to what's going on, not to be overly concerned, but just to let you know that the trends that we've been watching around us have caught up with us, and it's weighing heavy on some folks, but pretty resilient group, and we'll keep supporting them however we can and get through this.
I'd like to say one thing to any of the public out there. Please be safe, be careful. We want to keep you around. for a long time. You're our neighbors and friends. So thank you. So and that with that, motion to conclude.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second.
Okay, discussion. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Thank you. See you soon. Take care.
Yep.